Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it in the bathroom and drown the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Terrence Heath about, you know, this shooting for some has highlighted the lack of mental health facilities, the lack of mental health treatment. I'm saying this is an economic thing. This isn't a hope. This is an opportunity thing. This kid, had he been able to look in the future and say, you know what? I'm going to have a future. I'm going to be able to get a good job. I'm going to be able to raise a family and move on to the future. Who knows? But we'll talk about how the economic conditions in this country are making our society ripe for these things and other types of social unrest. So that should be interesting. Also, Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress is going to be here talking about Mike Lee, senator from Utah, who has an interesting view of the Constitution, and it'll be an interesting conversation because there are folks right now who are the strict constitutionalists. We're the originalists. We know what the founders wanted. So we'll talk about that in regards to child labor laws because according to him, according to Mike Lee, the states should decide if children work in the factories or not. Yeah, good idea. In the second hour, we're going to talk with Ruth Milkman, professor of sociology at UCLA and the City University of New York, about paid family medical leave and how the state of California 6 years ago enacted pay for people who need to take care of a sick family member, people who want to take care of their children who are coming into the world. I've used the Family Medical Leave Act, unpaid, mind you. And I think a lot more people would take advantage of it if there were some pay along with it. And also today marks the 15th, 16th anniversary of the Superior Court decision here in Pennsylvania that said an employer can fire someone just because they're gay. And I guess the question I have is, do I have to know you're gay or can I suspect it? And we'll talk to the guy who this case is based on, Dan Miller, who is the founder of the GLBT Business Association here in Harrisburg and also a political activist. Well, it appears that the morning thing is over. It appears the holding hands is over. Republicans are moving forward on their repealing the job killing health care law act. There's talk maybe change that a little bit. Repealing the Obama job killing health care act. That's their way of toning it down a little bit. We will see. But they're going to go full steam ahead, take your right to health care away, take your health care away, all those people who have benefited from this. It's going to be interesting. What I'm going to focus on in particular is the type of language that they use, because I think they are so well trained to stay on message, so well trained to use that hot language It's going to be interesting to see that during the debate how long it takes for them, just how long it's going to take them to slide right back into that hate rhetoric. So that's going to be something I think is going to be interesting to keep an eye on, because they've become so accustomed to it. The buzzwords are so well focus group tested. They know what they need to do. Now they just have this other thing they've got to deal with. So it'll be interesting to see where we go and how this works out as we move forward, because they still got this political balancing act right now. People are paying attention to this stuff. So it will be interesting to see how we move forward on this.
There's a report coming out of Washington, according to The Hill, which is a political tabloid, that the repeal-backing Republicans are maintaining their taxpayer-supported health insurance. Last week, Lee Fong, who works for Think Progress, which is a left-leaning publication, asked newly elected Representative Robert Hurd, a Republican from Virginia, who campaigned on a promise, as quite a few did who got voted into Congress, campaigned on a promise to repeal health care reform. To give you an idea where these people are coming from, I want to give you an exchange between Lee Fong of Think Progress and Congressman Hurt. Congressman Hurt was talking about the health care he has. It's a policy that's issued by Anthem, insurance carrier, and it's a policy that it's open to the public, according to Congressman Hurt. Think Progress then asked him, but my tax dollars and everybody's tax dollars subsidize your plan as a member of Congress and all of your staff members. You've got, 30 members of your staff? Do you think they should have government-sponsored health care if you're going to repeal it for anyone else? Congressman Hurt, and this is exactly why people are very leery of politicians. Now listen to what his answer was. If you're going to pay members of Congress anything, they're going to have a salary and they're going to have benefits like so many people who are employed do, then I think it's not unreasonable to offer those benefits. So I support that. Sure good to know, Rick, that he doesn't think it's not unreasonable for him and other healthcare repealers to get decent healthcare coverage, but apparently quite unreasonable to share that good fortune with the rest of the country. You know, the folks who pay for his salary and most of his healthcare. Can you say hypocrite?
Well, we'll see as this goes forward where this leads us. And, you know, the whole talk of you know, tamping down the rhetoric, tamping down the heat in this, kind of makes me take a step back when I look at Louie Gohmert, a Texas Republican who he actually wants to have the ability, he wants to carry guns on the floor of the well of the House. Is that what we want? I don't know. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future. We're back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Harry Moser says the reshoring initiative he founded has the potential to bring back U.S. jobs lost to offshoring to China and other countries overseas. He says the key is for corporations to consider the true total cost of ownership of offshoring compared to domestic operations. Moser has developed a software for companies to discover all the true total costs involved, which he says many companies underestimate by 20%.
The objective of the initiative is to change the sourcing mindset, and it's a very strong mindset these days. Right now, offshore is cheaper. The logic behind this, the reason to believe that there's a chance for it to work, is a study that was done in 2009 that shows that 60% of manufacturers apply only rudimentary or simple total cost models. They ignore 20% or more of the total cost of offshore products.
UAW President Bob King told the Automotive News Global Congress in Detroit that as the union tries to organize foreign transplant auto factories in the U.S., his message to those companies is that the UAW has changed its philosophy.
We have completely discarded the outdated remnants of us versus them mentality that resulted in the past in rigid work rules and narrow job classifications.
But King also says the unfettered right to organize is a must, and he warned foreign car makers against obstructing the UAW's organizing efforts.
We will launch a global campaign to brand that company as a human rights violator.
North Dakota is attempting to make it more difficult for workers to leave a job without giving 10 days' notice. Jesse Russell reports.
Many states have laws protecting employees from being laid off without receiving a reasonable amount of notice from employers. But what about employees that don't give employers enough notice? North Dakota is considering a bill that would allow businesses to withhold accrued time off if a worker doesn't give 10 days' notice before quitting. The North Dakota AFL-CIO is against the bill, with President David Chemnitz saying during a committee hearing on Wednesday that it would tie the hands of workers who may need to suddenly leave a job for reason of harassment or for medical emergencies. The bill would specifically target employees who have been at a business for less than 2 years.
Should a governor have the right to ban state employees from calling into radio talkos? Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee does and has placed such a ban on state workers under his control. Under the ban, workers may not call into for-profit talk radio programs during state work hours. Chafee did clarify that the ban applies specifically to for-profit radio, and officials are allowed to go on public radio stations like National Public Radio. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Right now is the time to start. And you know what? I've been saying for the longest time, the first thing we have to fix is our economy. I think a lot of our problems would be solved if we could get the economy turned around. And I look at this shooting, and you know, as horrible and as tragic it is, as it is, part of me says that the economic conditions in this country had some play in that. Just my opinion on that. I've got Terrence Heath on the line. He's from the Campaign for America's Future. Ourfuture.org is the website. He's written really a good piece that I think is worth taking a look at. We've got it linked over at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Terrence, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this shooting, and as horribly tragic it is, as it is, there are some lessons that I think we should be taking from it.
Well, a lot has been said about the inflammatory rhetoric and the need to change the tone of our public discourse. But turning down the volume and talking nicely isn't enough, I think, because in part the inflammatory and incendiary rhetoric has always been a part and is going to be a part of our political system. Yep. Passion is a part of our politics. That's a spark. It's meant to inflame. The problem is that we're surrounded by economic conditions that amount to kindling. We've got high unemployment plus all of the stresses that go along with that, that people are living with. Everything from just general stress to increased drug and alcohol use, increased mental health issues at a time when states have fewer resources to deal with. And the inflammatory rhetoric is part of the problem, but the bigger problem is the conditions that have been brought about by the economic crisis that we still haven't addressed.
Right. And you know what I've been saying is, look, the economy's in the tank, and you've got a media structure who's saying, well, you know, it's the government, it's those public sector unions, it's those unions, those people who still have health care and those people who still have pensions. They're the reason the economy's doing so bad. And what do you expect? You know, people who, this kid that did the shooting, unemployed for 6 months, no prospect of finding a job.
Right. And he's part of an age group of young people in the country that are coming out of college, a lot of them, and coming into a job market that doesn't have a place for them.
You know,
isn't looking like it's going to make a place for them.
Right, and all the rhetoric we hear, oh, Social Security's not going to be around, you're going to be saddled with $100 trillion worth of debt, all of this negativity, all of this doomsday, you know, the end of the world's May 21st, you know, all of this stuff, not good.
At some point, we have to start, like I said, cleaning up the kindling. When I was in the Boy Scouts, we learned how to build a fire. One of the things we did was we cleared the area of anything that might catch spark and start an uncontrollable blaze. And that's what we are living in right now. It's the difference between dropping a match on bare dirt and dropping a match in a forest after a year's worth of drought.
Yeah, and so where do we start? I mean, you look at the poverty numbers are going through the roof, wage stagnation for 30 years, mass inequality, and really the loss of true opportunity where you could, you know, start off at a meager position and find your way into the middle class. Where do we start?
There are plenty of places to start. And the first place, I think, is that we need a job plan, a job program that focuses on direct investment in job creation. And I'm not talking about tax cuts and hoping that somehow people use those to invest in ways to create jobs. I'm talking about putting people to work, doing work that the country needs done right now on infrastructure, and in states where there's high rates of unemployment, especially targeting those areas, not just for infrastructure projects, but also to keep vital services going that people need even more in a crisis than they have before. And right now, states are in a position where they are looking at cutting those services. The county where this shooting happened in Arizona had recently cut 50% of its mental health services.
Wow.
I don't know if that would have stopped this young man from doing what he did if there had been more of those resources. But in states across the country, the same thing is happening. And what you have is you have a situation where people are experiencing increasing stress, and states have fewer resources to deal with it. That's what I mean by kindling. The inflammatory rhetoric is what drops the match, is what sparks it. But a spark doesn't start a fire if it doesn't have fuel.
Right. And there's plenty of fuel going around. Look, I know several people who have been unemployed for greater than 99 weeks. They are now off on their own.
Exactly. That's exactly it. They're on their own, and an increasing number of people, if we don't take action and if there's no plan to do something about it, are essentially going to be abandoned, are being abandoned in this economic crisis. It is the you're on your own attitude that we saw for the last 8 years before the Obama administration. And that was a period of time during which we reversed a decade's worth of progress in reducing poverty. Wages were stagnant for more than a decade. The rich got richer. I don't have to tell you the story. You know it.
Yep.
That's what put us in the worst possible position for this crisis when it did in 2007.
Yeah, and, you know, and I look at the third quarter numbers for corporate America, the largest amount of profit that they've had on record, sitting on piles of trillions of dollars of cash.
Exactly.
Yeah, we've got 10% unemployment. Like I said, I know several people. They're the 99ers. They're the folks who are on their own. And I remember this debate when we were talking about extending unemployment for just a short period of time. I remember saying, look, at the end of the day, for the people who are on unemployment, there will be a Christmas dinner. There will be something there one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that one way or another that scares me.
Right, but for some people, there won't be another. There won't be another way. And that's part of the thing that we've got to get our brains around in terms of economic investment. It's also keeping people afloat during this period of unemployment. We need to focus on, first of all, putting people back to work. But at the same time, in those states where there are high rates and in those local areas where there are high rates of unemployment, we need to focus on also extending unemployment benefits.
Absolutely agree.
It's a question of not just of what kind of country we want to be, but realizing that we can't afford not to.
for just these reasons. Absolutely. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Terrence Heath. He's from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org is the website. His piece is, it's not just inflammatory rhetoric. It's worth a good, it's a good read, worth the time. We've got a link over at our site at thericksmithshow.com. You know, one of the things that you talk about in this piece is the inequality. The fact that the richest 400, our Forbes 400, have nearly doubled their share of all the earned income in this country. To me, that is a massive problem. But during the election, all we kept hearing from the well-funded Tea Party is redistribution of wealth. You're talking about redistribution of wealth.
Well, we've been redistributing wealth, except we've been redistributing it from the top. From the bottom to the top.
Well, from my pocket to theirs.
Exactly.
And yours, and everybody listening to this, all the money's been taken out of our pockets and put into the folks who are at the very top.
And we already know that it doesn't spur economic growth. And it's not just coming from me, it's coming from the CBO and places like Moody's Analysis. Tax cuts are the least bang for the buck in terms of, and that's how we've been transferring wealth upward. Is with tax cuts are the least bang for the buck in terms of job creation and economic growth because, according to Moody's analysis, the rich don't spend their tax cut.
Nope.
It doesn't go back into the economy.
Oh, it goes into a economy, and I agree with the Republicans. They create jobs. In fact, the tax cuts create millions and millions of jobs.
The only problem
is it's not here.
Exactly. Not here.
And how long is it going to be before we learn this lesson? It was the same in the 80s when Reagan did it. It's the same, you know, when the Shrub did it. When are we going to learn?
I keep thinking that I'm not an economist, so maybe there's some esoteric point that I'm missing. But I'm starting not to believe that anymore,
you know,
because it's pretty clear that if you invest in putting people in the middle and working class back to work and keeping them working, that money gets spent. It gets spent in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our cities. It gets funneled into our local and state governments in the form of property taxes, and it supports the services that we need supported, in terms of keeping teachers in our schools. We're at a point now where we're actually thinking or talking about how many teachers can we afford to just let be fired and lose their job?
It's insane, isn't it?
It's insane.
And I got to be honest. I wake up every morning expecting Bill Murray to be next to me and hearing that stupid Sonny and Cher song, like in Groundhog Day. I mean, it just never ends. And I get the same people who are struggling day after day after day telling me the reason that we're struggling is because the government. And I'm going, well, what do you mean the government? The government didn't tell all of these manufacturers to leave the country.
There are two things that we as progressives need to do and that the Democrats need to do if they want to take back Congress and hold on to the White House. And that is, one, make the case for how we got here. Make it clear how we got here in terms of the wars fought off the books, in terms of tax cuts that were never paid for and never found their way back into the economy that didn't benefit the middle and working class here. And then we've got to make a convincing case for direct investment in our infrastructure, in job creation, and show people this is what it's going to do in your community. This is how many people are going to be put to work in your community. These are the services that are going to keep running and be there when you need them. And if the right can come up with a plan that can do the same thing, then we can have a debate about it. I don't think they will because their political philosophy doesn't allow for it.
Well, no, and I don't think we ever will have that honest, open discussion. I think right now we're just getting a little smoke, a little smoke and mirrors, and at the end of it, we're going to go right back to where we started.
The reason I think we have to do this work, though, is because whatever happens in the next 2 years, there is, according to all the polls that I've seen, a wide segment of the population that wants the economy back to working for working people, that want services supported.
But But is this guy, is President Obama the guy who's
going
community.
To do it? And they just want it to work. They right. want something to work. And in 2 years, I can almost guarantee the Republicans aren't going to make anything work for anyone of the people that I'm talking about.
No, it's just about grandstanding for the next 2 years for them.
But
because
we
they think
have to have something that we can show will work.
Right. Do you think President Obama is the guy who's going to be able to push this, even if we do this work? Because I got to be I'm honest, I'm not encouraged by the folks he's put into his cabinet recently.
It's one of those things that I think that's part of the work that we're going to have to do is to make that case. Progressives are going to have to be able to operate and work independently of the White House and move people independently of the administration and thus move the administration. And I think that's the reality. I think that in some ways it may depend on which guy shows up. The guy that I saw speaking in Arizona might be able to do that.
Yeah.
It's a question of building that critical mass, that movement that helps make the case to even the administration, look, this is what you have to do if you want to be to stay where you are, to be able to do all of the other things you said you wanted to do.
Right.
And the people will back you up on this. If you take this stand, people will back you up. We will bring them to back you up. We will make the case with you and for you. And I think that's just part of the work that we have to do.
Right, and it goes back to jobs. I mean, I said from the beginning,
yeah.
had they done the job creation that needed to be done,
yeah.
this last November wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, and I'm right there with you, and we said that and said it and jumped up and down, screamed and yelled, and at some point, I think that we have to keep saying it, and at some point, make it so plain that it can't possibly be missed.
That even I can see it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just the same work that we've been doing, and we're going to have to continue doing because it's at this point it's not the goal is probably not getting something passed in Congress. Although who knows? The goal is to have a clear program, a clear plan that I can explain to the next person that I meet on the train on the way to work, or that I'm riding up with in an elevator, or that you can explain to your family over the dinner table, that makes a clear case, a clear and convincing case.
And that's what we've got to do. The piece is, it's not just inflammatory rhetoric by Terrence Heath. We can get that over our site at thericksmithshow.com. Terrence is from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. Terrence, always great to talk to you. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Time for another Gooberhead Award, presented periodically to those in the news who have their tongues running 100 miles an hour but forgot to put their minds in gear. Today, I've got a mess of GOP goobers for you. Three politicos who keep stumbling over things like facts. First, John Kyle, the Arizona senator who tried to kill a bill in December that will finally provide medical benefits for those firefighters, police, and other heroic 9/11 rescuers who are now horribly ill because of the toxins they absorbed at Ground Zero. Kyle wailed that Democrats had rushed the bill to the floor without a hearing. Rushed? John, 9/11 happened a decade ago, and many of the heroes have already died, waiting in vain for Congress to act, including the callous inaction by you and your party during all those years that Republicans control Congress and the White House. No hearing? John, the Senate Committee on Health held one last June, and you could have participated had you just walked down the hall from your office. But you chose not to. Next come a couple of stumblebum governors. Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota recently blasted Obama for bloating the public payroll by 590,000 government jobs since 2008. Governor, Obama didn't take office until 2009. In fact, in Obama's two-year tenure, the number of public employees is down by 300,000. Then there's Rick Perry of Texas, who says he hates big government. Echoing the noted historian, Glenn Beck, Rick says that big bad government started when Woodrow Wilson pushed the 16th Amendment into the Constitution, creating the income tax. That's a punchy political anecdote, only it's false. The 16th Amendment was approved under a Republican president before Wilson took office. This is Jim Hightower saying, goobers never let facts get in the way of a good story.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Fancy dishes and little doilies and holding your pinky up and all of that. I got to tell you, during the whole election cycle this last time around, the Tea Party guys, the candidates really were kind of amusing. I had hoped they weren't going to win, but they were amusing. Now that some of them have won, now it's just plain scary. And a lot of it comes back down to what they believe. And I think a lot of it has to do with this idea that, you know, the Constitution is this written in stone document that can never be changed, and the only things written in the document are only things we can do. This idea of constitutional originalism, or like Scalia, for instance. But this guy, this senator from Utah, Mike Lee, really kind of an interesting view and scary on another level. Ian Millhiser wrote an interesting piece over at Think Progress, where Mike Lee calls child labor laws unconstitutional. So I've asked Ian to come on the program and talk to us a little bit about this. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back, Rick.
Yeah, it's great having you. I look at this guy, and, you know, if he were just one of my friends, you know, at the bar or at work spewing this kind of nonsense, I would just kind of chuckle. But this guy's a United States senator.
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. I mean, and it's funny because, you know, I always kind of secretly thought that when right-wing lawmakers get together, they pour themselves a $60 glass of scotch and talk about how awesome it would be to go back to when child labor laws are unconstitutional. But, like, they're normally smart enough not to say it in public. And, you know, I mean, the thing that surprises me the most about this, you know, I've known this guy was crazy for a while, but the fact that he was dumb enough to actually reveal this agenda that he has, which is really quite terrifying.
You know, one of the things I said about this last election cycle and the whole funding of the Tea Party is that the people who have been whispering these kind of things to each other in their think tanks, they kind of felt emboldened. And, you know, John Racey, the guy who ran in West Virginia, was out there saying kind of the same stuff. Child labor laws unconstitutional, unemployment unconstitutional, Joe Miller out in Alaska. Another one, you had all these people who were saying this stuff, and...
Yeah, and it's not just the people who lost. I mean, you know, it's Mike Lee saying this now. You know, Senator Coburn recently said that he thinks that all education programs are all federal education programs are unconstitutional. So if you have a Pell Grant or if you have student loan assistance, you're out of luck. Senator Rand Paul, of course, had that infamous interview where he said that the ban on whites-only lunch counters is unconstitutional. So, I mean, this is rampant. I mean, there are a large numbers of lawmakers in the United States Congress who think that pretty much everything that we accomplish in the 20th century violates the Constitution.
It's insane. And the case that you're an attorney, correct?
I am. That's right.
The case that he cites, this Hammer versus Dagenhardt, What he says about this, he says, quote, in that case, the Supreme Court acknowledged that something very interesting, that as reprehensible as child labor is, and as much as it ought to be abandoned, that's something that has to be done by the state legislators, not by members of Congress. And he says, goes on to say, that may sound harsh, but it's designed to be that way. The Constitution, he's saying, is designed to be a little bit harsh.
Yeah, I mean, he's got this bizarre notion. So what the Constitution says is that Congress can regulate commerce among the several states. And so Lee has this strange notion, and that Hammer decision that he mentioned has this strange notion, because most people don't cross a state line when they're at work. You know, people stay at their desk or they stay at wherever they're working. Somehow that means that they're not engaged in any type of interstate commerce. And the problem with that is, you know, let's say I work in a bakery in Pennsylvania. If I'm in this Pennsylvania bakery, I'm taking flour from wheat that was grown in Kansas and eggs that were grown in Iowa and sugar from Florida. I'm mixing it all up in a bowl that was made in Ohio and I'm cooking it in an oven that was made in New York. So the idea that a worker can somehow be removed from the national stream of commerce is ridiculous. You know, the basic problem is that Mike Lee doesn't understand how the economy works.
Well, that's true as well. But, you know, I was talking to one of my friends who is one of these originalists, and he has this bizarre belief that the Constitution is nothing more than an economic treaty among the different states. So each state is like its own country, and we just agree to have a mutual economy and this mutual defense pact. Kind of weird to me. But there's a thought process that goes along with that.
There is, but, frankly, it's just wrong. I mean, the Articles of the Confederation, you know, the document that we scrapped to get our Constitution, does do what he described. That largely was just a mutual defense pact. The Constitution that we have, and, you know, I want to push back a little bit about what you're saying about originalism. You know, I don't agree with Scalia, but a big reason why I disagree with people like Scalia is because they're bad historians. The framers were very clear that they thought that there were national matters that had to be dealt with by a national government, and one of them is regulating our nation's economy. You know, they put that in the document, and, you know, that was as true in 1789 as it is true now.
You know, one of the questions that I have then, you know, because, you know, I've had this conversation, and I've been accused of being wrong, that I believe the Constitution is a living document. I believe that it was meant to be changed, not easily, but it was meant to be changed as times changed. But my one friend, he believes that nothing should have ever been changed and it should have been, just the way it is.
Well, I think, like, there's two different things that our Constitution does. One is it says what powers government has. So it says Congress can regulate commerce, Congress can create post offices, it can spend money, it gives this laundry list of things that Congress is allowed to do. And then the second thing that it does is it gives us rights. You know, so we can't have a right to free speech taken away. We can't have our right to freedom of religion taken away. And some of those rights-granting provisions are intentionally written in very ambiguous language. You can't be punished in a cruel and unusual way. There's even a provision in the Constitution which says that you can't lose the privileges and immunities of citizenship. And now, you know, Scalia will say with respect to those rights-granting provisions that they should be locked in place. But, you know, if your rights to, like, if framers had a notion of what it meant to be cruel and unusual punishment and what punishments were allowed and what punishments were not allowed, they could have written a laundry list in it. They could have said you can't do the following things. But they didn't do that. They used this open-ended language, and that's their way of telling us, hey, you know, you're going to have to give these words meaning in modern society. And, you know, and then that is what they intended the document to do.
So let's look at going back to Mike Lee. This notion that it's up to the states. And like anything, any of these arguments that, well, the states should decide, especially with right to any labor law, in my opinion, that is an automatic race to the bottom, because you're going to find one state that's going to allow 10-year-olds to work in the looms again.
No, that's exactly right. And that's what we saw happen, you know, in the area leading up, in the period leading up to the Great Depression, when these Supreme Court decisions were in effect.
And what frightens me is I look at the Scalia court, and I wonder if it, or the Roberts court, actually, if we could go back to the Lochner era where you brought up bakeries. You know, the Bake Shop Act there in New York pretty much put all labor law as unconstitutional, any maximum hour laws, any minimum wage laws, all of that stuff, because of liberty of contract, unconstitutional.
I mean, the good news there is that there's only one justice on this Supreme Court, Justice Thomas, who's outright said, yeah, I love the Lochner era. Let's go back to that. I mean, even Scalia, who's, you know, probably the next most conservative justice on the Supreme Court, has said that, you know, that's way too far for him. The bad news is you have the Bush v. Gore precedent, where, you know, they threw out everything they've said in the past because they wanted George Bush to be president more than they wanted Al Gore to be president. And so there's always a risk that, you know, if these justices care enough about something, then they'll just throw out all the precedent and do whatever they want.
But in reality, this child labor law thing, the child stuff, that's never going to fly, because as a society, we've become accustomed to not having children working in the looms and working in the mines.
Right, and that's a really good point. You know, the justices may have life tenure, but they're not immune to political realities. You know, they know there would be an uprising if tomorrow they tried to say, you know, not just all labor laws, but, you know, if you accept Mike Lee's theory, then we have to get rid of the ban on whites-only lunch counters. We, you know, he even said in his at a different point in his lecture that Social Security and Medicare aren't allowed. So, you know, we're going to tell all of our seniors tomorrow, sorry, you're going to lose your retirement benefits and don't get sick. You know, there would be people in the streets if they pulled that kind of thing.
Yeah, but how much of that do you think is actually pure rhetoric, and how much of it is him saying, you know, what, well, we want to push this tenther idea, this idea that the states are sacrosanct and we can, so that business can move away from the Northeast, and we can see this kind of this beggar thy neighbor economic development that's been going on, where states are pitted against each other, really in a race towards the bottom.
I mean, I think part of what the problem is with someone like Mike Lee is that he doesn't understand that the law isn't a game. I mean, you know, the nice thing about these comfortable theories like tentherism is they make the law really simple. You know, there aren't very many hard constitutional questions under tentherism. And so if you're, you know, if you want to look at the law like it's a math problem, you know, you can get the answer you want. You can say you know the answer, and that's very satisfying. The problem is that the answers that you get to that math problem, if you do it the way that the tenthers do, lead to immeasurable human suffering. You know, I mean, imagine if we had kids working in coal mines. You know, imagine if we didn't have Social Security. Imagine if we brought back whites-only lunch counters. And I think, you know, the proper response of a civilized country is to say that, you know, any theory of interpreting the Constitution that leads to nine-year-old boys in coal mines, that cannot possibly be our values.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But, you know, the more I look at this, the more and it's interesting you brought up the simplistic language, because I'm not an attorney. I, you know, my friend that I argue with, he's not an attorney, but we have these discussions, and it sometimes ends up being the simplest frame that we walk away with.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that, you know, the law is hard, you know, and constitutional law is hard. The Constitution is a very short document. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of federal laws. And the reason why there's so many pages is because to provide people with certainty about what the law is, you have to give them very specific instructions, and that requires a lot of words. The Constitution is a short document, and because it's short, it means that it's hard to interpret, because there isn't a lot of explanation there about what to do in every circumstance.
You know, given this last election, Ian, how many people do you think hold the same views as Senator Lee from Utah, do you think?
I think very few, and I think it's wonderful that Senator Lee is being honest about what he thinks, because I think that a lot of people who, you know, were scared in the last election, I think that there's a lot of people who were susceptible to rhetoric in the last election, and I don't blame them. I mean, you know, things were really hard for the last 3 years, and, you know, people had a right to be angry. But, you know, I also think that most Americans, as they start to see the truth of what people think, you know, if they know that their senator thinks that child labor laws should be taken off the table, they're going to want another senator.
Yeah, and now those are the things that we have to point out, and I'm glad you guys do the work over there at the Center for American Progress in pointing this stuff out, because I think it's extremely important.
Well, thank you.
Ian, I appreciate your time. I look forward to having you back real soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org is the website. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save nine, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, in talking to Ian, who is a brilliant guy in my opinion, you know, I always feel dumb talking to them because, look, I'm not a lawyer. I understand what some of these things are about. The Lochner era, for instance, a quick synopsis of as I know, a guy named Joseph Lochner owned a bake shop. In 1905, and the state of New York passed a law, said you can't work your employees past 60 hours. Well, it turns out Lochner said, I don't care about that law. We're going to let my work, I'm going to have my workers work 70, 80, 100, whatever. So he was fined. And the first time he paid it, second time, they went and they took it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled liberty of contract. If a worker is willing to work 70, 100, 200, whatever, every minute of every day, it's his ability to say under liberty of contract. Now, what that takes out is, you know, people have to eat. And when you have a glut of employment, conditions can be bogged down. So I can easily find someone willing to work for less than this guy, work in more dangerous conditions, whatever. I mean, that's there. And what they use this Lochner case for is to shoot down all maximum hour laws, all minimum wage laws, you know, all of the labor laws that had to do with an agreement between an employee and an employer, because they said, citing liberty of contract. So when you talk about that, and you talk about going back to the Lochner era, you talk about this one case that could pretty much do away with most of the labor progress we've had in this country. So if you like your 40-hour work week, for instance, and you don't know where it came from, because the work weeks used to be sun up to sun down 6 days a week. That's what it used to be. If you like minimum wage laws, you know, hey, I'm going to make at least the minimum wage. People fought for that. And, you know, you go through all of the things that we enjoy. There's a history behind that. Granted, we generally don't know it, but there is. Our quote of the day comes from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who wrote a letter to President Obama. He said, quote, I urge you to once again make clear to the American people that under your watch, we will not cut Social Security benefits, raise the retirement age, or privatize this critical program. He goes on to say Social Security is a promise that we cannot and must not break. And The Hill's reporting that a broad coalition of labor unions, liberal groups, and pro-Social Security groups are lobbying the White House to advise the president not to include any discussion about Social Security in his State of the Union address. Because, you know, you look at what came out of the Simpson-Bowles committee. We want to raise the rates. They raise the age. They want to cut some of the benefits. Look, if it's something we have to do, I mean, if we eventually have to cut the benefits and raise the age, it should be after we go after the folks who have the resources. I've said from the very beginning what should happen with Social Security, and I could make it solvent forever. We do away with the cap. We lower the rate. You go down from the 12.5% rate. You take that down. Maybe 5%, maybe 6% on every penny of income. And we change the definition of income to include capital gains. Because when my bank account earns $18 like it did last year, I still have to claim that. Still have to claim it. Let's go to the phones. I got Ike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Ike?
Hey, brother. How are you?
I am fantastic.
Being someone who's, you know, late mother, rest in peace, was a union representative and assistant business agent, and he comes from a family that's got a great uncle in the bloodline that was killed by the Pinkertons out in front of Ford's Rouge plant in Detroit. I take this stuff real serious. It's amazing to me how ignorant the average person on the street is out there. It's a shame, really, and it's also a shame that, there's so many things that in the way of history that our schools fail to teach, but that's one big part that, it really belongs in the civics or government class, you know, to where these kids could be taught, you know, how they got to the society that they live in, including, you know, another thing you left out would be OSHA. You know, a lot of people think the government just created OSHA out of the goodness of their heart. They don't realize a lot of people got poisoned and died because we didn't have that.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and the other thing that, you know, I try and convey to people is that, you know, we take vacations and sick days and all of these things for granted because this benevolent employer bestowed them upon us. And, you know, to me, I'm going, how did you come up with that? How did you come up with that?
Right. And, you know, living in the South for as long as I have, we're so far behind the times, it's not even, funny. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine just a couple days after Christmas, after 10 years of working for a company that he broke his neck working for, literally broke his neck and didn't sue him. But he worked for him for 10 years. He got kicked to the curb, you know, and no notice, no nothing. Out on his rear, he went. And now he's starting to come around because I've been telling him ever since I worked with him that, you know, if they could do it to me and all the other people that have been through that place, you know, he's nothing special, and he didn't believe it. But there's a lot of people out there that whistle past the graveyard every day, and it's just a crying shame the way employers are, you know, able to treat employees. And another big deal, too, you know, for the people that are unemployed out there, you know, I've listened to this garbage go on in the media talking about how you're a bum. You know, you don't want to work, and you don't have any right. You know, you shouldn't be sitting and drawing unemployment. And, you know, I try to tell my friends and, my, you know, people that, you know, have been on me about it, you know, look here, that's my money. And for anybody out there that's unemployed, you earn that money.
Absolutely.
That employer would have never been able to pay you unemployment if you hadn't worked for him to make the money in the first place. And you got to remember that, because people will beat you down. They will try to make you feel subhuman for taking any sort of benefit that we've, you know, put in place for this type of situation. And I know it gets to be pretty low when you don't have a job. But I'm telling you, don't let them do that to you, man. You're entitled to everything you can get. Because your labor is what paid for it.
Amen. Right there, brother.
Yep.
Appreciate the call, Ben.
All right, my friend.
Thanks so much. You know, and you look at this, Jake, and he's spot on. The more you talk to people, and I think this economic crisis is bringing people around, because we're seeing these stories. We're hearing about, you know, people being abused on the job. We're hearing about companies who are trying to cut folks' pay in half. We're hearing about wage theft.
Interfaith Worker Justice, which is an organization that has for years tried to keep on top of these things and the abuses within our country, they just came out with a video. And according to them, 60%, which is incredible, of nursing home workers, 100% of poultry plant workers, and 90% of restaurant workers at some time are denied fair pay at some time during their tenure. For instance, one worker by the name of, I'm probably going to butcher this, Rashid Abowitz of Chicago, who says on the video his employer refused to pay him at all for three consecutive pay periods. Diane Enrique, also in the video, is one of three San Francisco restaurant workers who did not receive overtime pay. They sued their employer. They won about $7,000. According to Kim Bobo, who's a spokesman for this organization, Interfaith Workers Justice, executive director, this is what they said. It's really all around us. The workers who are not getting paid minimum wage, not paid overtime, misclassified as independent contractors so employers can avoid having to pay benefits, who don't get all their tips. Some workers get laid off and don't get their last paycheck. There's a new report that just came out this week, ironically, right? Issued this week, backs up their findings also. Nearly half of immigrant day laborers surveyed in New Jersey were not paid for the work they completed. So it's not only been with us a while, and I think you're right, the economic downturn has exasperated it, but it's at tremendous levels, just unbelievable, 60% or higher in some areas.
And the only recourse is to sue, and then all you get is what you were entitled to, but you probably end up losing your job.
And then if you're an undocumented, you know what I'm saying, what are your chances? You lose if you win.
Kim Bobo wrote an interesting book, Wage Theft in America, A Crisis We Can Solve. It's worth taking a look at. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ruth Milkman, professor at UCLA and the City University of New York, going to talk about paid family medical leave, something I think we really, really need. I know it would have been nice if it was when I used it. We're right back after this.
Drowning in traffic lights. Save the USA and resume the ties it binds. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job, join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Harry Moser says the reshoring initiative he founded has the potential to bring back U.S. jobs lost to offshoring to China and other countries overseas. He says the key is for corporations to consider the true total cost of ownership of offshoring compared to domestic operations. Moser has developed a software for companies to discover all the true total costs involved, which he says many companies underestimate by 20%.
The objective of the initiative is to change the sourcing mindset, and it's a very strong mindset these days. So right now, offshore is cheaper. The logic behind this, the reason to believe that there's a chance for it to work, is a study that was done in 2009 that shows that 60% of manufacturers apply only rudimentary or simple total cost models. They ignore 20% or more of the total cost of offshore products.
UAW President Bob King told the Automotive News Global Congress in Detroit that as the union tries to organize foreign transplant auto factories in the U.S., his message to those companies is that the UAW has changed its philosophy.
We have completely discarded the outdated remnants of us versus them mentality that resulted in the past in rigid work rules and narrow job classifications.
But King also says the unfettered right to organize is a must, and he warned foreign car makers against obstructing the UAW's organizing efforts.
We will launch a global campaign to brand that company as a human rights violator.
North Dakota is attempting to make it more difficult for workers to leave a job without giving 10 days' notice. Jesse Russell reports.
Many states have laws protecting employees from being laid off without receiving a reasonable amount of notice from employers. But what about employees that don't give employers enough notice? North Dakota is considering a bill that would allow businesses to withhold accrued time off if a worker doesn't give 10 days notice before quitting. The North Dakota AFL-CIO is against the bill, with President David Chemnitz saying during a committee hearing on Wednesday that it would tie the hands of workers who may need to suddenly leave a job for reason of harassment or for medical emergencies. The bill would specifically target employees who have been at a business for less than 2 years.
Should a governor have the right to ban state employees from calling into radio talk shows? Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee believes he does and has placed such a ban on state workers under his control. Under the ban, workers may not call into for-profit talk radio programs during state work hours. Chafee did clarify that the ban applies specifically to for-profit radio, and officials are allowed to go on public radio stations like National Public Radio. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, among my Democratic Party loyalist friends, I've been known to point out my displeasures with former President Bill Clinton. And yeah, I know he wasn't as bad as George H.W. Bush or as bad as maybe Bob Dole could have been. But, you know, there wasn't there an awful lot to get excited about if you were a working person, if you're a union member, for instance. My Democratic Party friends love to point out that that Bill signed the Family Medical Leave Act, for which I give him great credit. But he also signed it with no money either. 6 years ago, the state of California passed a way for families to take care of their sick, to welcome a new child into the world while not losing their job and maybe not losing all of their savings. And a new study has been released to look back over the last 6 years and evaluate how it has worked out. Ruth Milkman is a professor of sociology at UCLA. She is also the co-author of the study, Leaves That Pay, Employer and Worker Experience That Paid Family Leave in California. Dr. Milkman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the study, can you lay some of the groundwork for the law out there in California, what was done 6 years ago, for people here who don't know?
One of our findings, actually, is that people don't know about this program. It was created back in 2002, and it took effect in 2004. It's one of two such programs in the United States. New Jersey has something similar, although much more recently established. And in both cases, the programs are designed to provide income for workers who take time off from work either to bond with a new baby, and this could be both mothers and fathers, or to take care of a seriously ill family member. So you can get, under this program, eligible leave can be compensated at about 55% of the person's normal weekly pay for up to 6 weeks. There is a cap on that, 55% up to a cap of about $1,000 a month.
But it's something. And, you know, because I've taken family leave, the federal family leave, under both to care for a family member and to welcome our children into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in both occasions, you know, it was out of our pocket. It was our savings. You know, I was appreciative for the time off, but it was also an economic hardship.
Well, exactly. So the federal law provides only unpaid leave. This one is paid, though not at 100%. So it's a pretty big deal for the United States. This was the first such program in the country. And the reason it's so important for working people is that, well, I should correct that, for low-wage workers in particular, is that people higher up in the labor market tend to have employer-provided benefits of this kind that are, you know, maybe not perfect, but relatively adequate, whereas low-wage workers generally have nothing, and they're also the folks who can least afford to take an unpaid leave. So this was a really big deal in that it promised to level the playing field between professionals and managers on the one hand and, you know, regular workers on the other who often had no benefits of this kind whatsoever.
Right. You know, I remember when this was being debated and the reaction from the, as I remember it, and help me if I'm wrong here, but the reaction from the business community was that it was going to be Armageddon for them and that people would be abusing it and nobody would ever come to work and there would be all
exactly.
of this crisis. Did your findings find any of that?
Well, we looked specifically at that because those were the claims that were made, and I might add those are the claims that are made frequently when any new government program of any kind affecting the workplace is proposed. You know, it's usually immediately denounced by the Chamber of Commerce as a job killer and all the rest of it. And this was no exception. That was those, all those claims were made. So what we did 6 years out, the program began in 2004, and last year we did a survey of about 250, it was actually 253, businesses around California. This is a representative survey, and it's also stratified by size. That is, we had equal numbers of firms of different numbers of employees. You'll see why in a minute.
Okay.
And we asked them questions like, what impact did the establishment of paid family leave have on your business? What impact did it have on your profitability? 89% said it had either no impact or a positive impact. What impact did it have on your productivity? 91% said no impact or a positive impact. What impact did it have on your turnover? Now, family leave can actually improve turnover. That is, increase retention, which saves employers money.
Right.
And 93% said it either had no effect on turnover or a positive effect. And finally, we asked about morale, and 99% said it was either neutral or positive. So all the, you know, hoopla about how this was going to be a disaster turned out to be untrue. We did ask about abuse as well, and only 9% of all the employers we surveyed had ever encountered any cases of abuse in the 6 years that the program had existed, and in most cases that was one incident. So, you know, basically this program is working pretty well for employers and also for workers. The big issue, if I could just jump to this point, I don't know how much more time we have left, but I really want to make sure this is included. The big issue that's sort of the downside of our study is that not enough people know this is out there, and the people who need it the most, low-wage workers, immigrant workers, Latinos in particular, are the least likely to be aware that it's out there. When they are aware of it and they use it, it's real beneficial to them, and I can say more about that if you want, but the challenge is to get the word out, and so maybe your program will help with that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's something I would love to have here in Pennsylvania. You know, paid sick time, paid family medical leave time. I think, as your statistics have pointed out, can only be good for employers because, you know, I know when an in-law was sick, it was a choice between, you know, having to quit the job and take care of them, or use this program, and fortunately the president passed it, but again, it was an economic hardship.
And no one should be forced to make that choice. These things happen to everybody at some time. You know, most people have children at some point. Everybody has parents, and those parents might get sick. with the aging of the population, we're going to have more and more need for this kind of thing. So this is the right thing to do, but it also is, you know, it is not bad for business. The other thing we found is that the family-friendly employers, those who do provide benefits themselves for these kind of situations, it turns out this subsidizes them. They actually save money as a result of its existence because what they do now, and many of them, about 60% of them in our survey said that they did this, they coordinate their own benefits with the state program,
which
means they have people who work for them apply for the state program, and they get 55% of their pay that way, and then they use the benefits that previously were providing 100% of people's pay to provide the other 45%. So they're actually saving money in those cases.
And this is, and I like to hear stuff like that because a good employer is being rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, this I'm a union focused guy, and I think that, you know, every worker should be in a labor union, and these are things that labor unions should be fighting for. But when I hear a state is doing this, and I hear corporations are doing the right thing, makes me happy.
Well, it's funny you should mention that about the labor movement, because this program was passed with great support from the California Labor Federation, and there was a big coalition that supported it. They were not the only, you know, force that pushed it, but they were very critical in getting it passed and signed. So it's not an accident that it's also had a good effect for working people. I mean, the people leading this effort understood that, that would be the case.
And that's good stuff. What else was in the study that you found?
Well, one of the things we found that we were very pleased to see is that the rate at which men are using the program has steadily increased over the life of the program. You know, it's a short life so far, only 6 years, but it's gone up quite dramatically in that period for baby bonding leaves in particular.
Absolutely.
And we don't know exactly why this has happened, but it has good effects on, you know, the endless quest for gender equality both at home and in the workforce. And we think that what's probably going on, and this is based on interviews, not the surveys themselves, is that for men, getting paid is kind of important if they're going to take a leave. You know, they might take a few days off if they become a father without pay, but, a significant paternity leave or whatever you want to call it, parental leave, isn't very attractive to men who feel that they're supposed to be getting paid all this. This is less of an issue for women if they can afford it. You know, and so we think that the existence of paid leave really has made a big difference for men and making it sort of legitimate, both in the eyes of their employers and in their own eyes, to go ahead and take advantage of this program.
Yeah, I know. When our children came into the world, I was fortunate enough to be able to save for that, because you're right. The pay thing for me was huge, but I was fortunate, was able to take 8 weeks, and it worked out pretty well, even though my employer, and I worked for a union company, didn't want to give that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're unusual. I mean, there were always some men who did it. But anyway, the extent to which that's occurring in California seems to be growing, and we think it's, you know, largely because of this program. So that's one piece of good news. The other thing we found is that, well, as you'd expect, the availability of wage replacement when someone's out on leave, you know, it makes life easier for the people who get that support. And so there are all kinds of beneficial effects on health, on the health of the children, on the health of the care recipient, if it's an elderly person or another ill family member. And one of the more dramatic examples of that we found is that the weeks that new mothers breastfeed double for those who use this program relative to those who take a leave and don't use it. That's very dramatic.
You just caught the attention of my wife, who I call the breast Nazi.
The nipple Nazi.
Yeah, that's her.
Somebody else used for the same thing, which is more alliterative. Yeah, well, we all, you know, the beneficial health effects for both mothers and children are well documented on this, and I think nowadays most new mothers are aware of that, but if they have to go back to work, sometimes it's very difficult to pull it off, and so this is another important benefit that will last for many years beyond the period of the leave itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you look at this, and I hear all the time the rhetoric that we're, you know, especially when coming from Republicans, that they're the family values party. And, you know, you look at the health care bill that was just out, and it just popped into my head thinking about my wife, that in the health care bill, there was a place in it where women who work would be able to have a room that was secure so that they could breastfeed, and how the right went crazy over that. How dare they force corporations to do this? And it's,
it will destroy the economy, right?
Yeah, well, kind of the same things that you were talking about with this paid family leave thing.
Yeah. Look, I understand understand how they feel. I mean, I've been a manager myself and run a small research organization. So, you know, you don't really want anybody telling you how to do it. I totally get where they're coming from. But, you know, sometimes human needs come first. And this is an example of that. So that what we've seen over time also is that employers adapt to this. So they oppose all these programs when they're in the proposal stage and they push back against them. Once they're legislated, they figure out how to make it work and move on, and that's what we've seen with this program.
And that's what
as well as I'm sure the many others that you're thinking of.
That's what I wanted to hear. Let's say we wanted to start a movement like this in Pennsylvania. Any advice on how they did it in California?
Yeah, well, actually, number of states, I'm not actually sure about Pennsylvania in particular, forgive me, but I haven't followed it there. But many, many states are trying to, there are campaigns underway to try to get similar kind of programs. So, again, it's just California and New Jersey so far that actually have programs functioning. But Washington State passed a law that doesn't yet have the appropriation that would be necessary to get the program going. And there's about 20 other states where it's being attempted. And in every case, it's a coalition effort, usually a combination of advocates for women, advocates for elders, and labor that get together and try to figure out how to build political support for this kind of thing. One thing I didn't mention that is relevant is that it's actually very inexpensive. California also has something called state disability insurance, which has been around since the 1940s, and that's for somebody's own serious medical condition that requires them to take over from work. If they, break their leg or have a heart attack or something, they can take advantage of this, and it's also used for pregnancy, which is in the United States.
It's pretty amazing.
That's considered a disability. So this builds on the same kind of thing. And the two together, paid family leave and SDI, are supported by 1.1% payroll deduction on the workforce that's covered, which is basically the entire private sector in the state of California. So it's very inexpensive.
So the workers are actually paying for it themselves.
Paying for it, exactly.
Excellent.
And we don't know how that breaks out, the 1.1, how much of that is paid family leave. But since the SDI part can be up to a year's leave, it's obviously less than half of the total,
right.
Particularly. So my point is, here's the thing. It's like insurance.
It sounds like unemployment insurance.
It's a little bit like unemployment insurance. You pay into the program, and when you have an event that, qualifies for a claim, you make a claim on, and you apply directly to the government. You don't, the employer is supposed to be notified, but they're not directly involved in the process.
Well, it sounds like an excellent program, and the study. I'm shocked at I guess I shouldn't be shocked at the numbers, but I am in the 90% for all. Kind of amazing to me.
And even though the Chamber of Commerce and so on will campaign against any program like this that's proposed in any other state, it's actually extremely politically popular. We did a survey of just Californians in general, asking them what they thought about this idea. This is how we also found out they didn't know they already had it, but around 90% of Californians support it, and that includes, conservative, white, male, religious Republicans. I mean, this is sort of an apple pie kind of issue, It's like common sense that it's a good thing.
Yep.
So it really is a matter of organizing to make it happen. And, of course, it really should happen at the federal level, not one state at a time. But
right.
We know the history in this country is that that's how you get changes, is to start at the states and, show that it can be done, and then hopefully it becomes a national program.
Absolutely agreed. Ruth Milkman, I appreciate the time. Professor of Sociology at UCLA. Again, thanks so much, and keep up the good work out there.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Take care.
You have a great night. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Jamie Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Saving work. In America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, I look at that, and I've used paid family medical leave, or I've used family medical leave, unpaid, of course, because we don't have it here. But I've used the Federal Family Medical Leave Act a couple of times. When an in-law was ill, I spent considerable time running back and forth to Philadelphia and back from Allentown to take care of them. When my children were born, took some time off, and all of it unpaid. And it became, and you know, fortunately, my wife at the time was making good money, and I was making good money, so it wasn't as big of an economic hardship. But what if you don't make a reasonable living? What if you're at the margin to begin with, and you have a sick relative or a child's born, and you need to take time off? How do you make it?
Also the factors that most people don't know, Rick. I mean, they weakened it a little bit. I mean, I know where I worked. They forced you to take your vacation first, depending on the situation. So the bill needs to be increased. You certainly need paid sick leave, but maybe we need to go revisit that and maybe strengthen it a bit.
You know, other countries, you know, they have pretty good paid sick time.
Paid, absolutely.
They have pretty good paid family time. Germany, for instance, has some of the best labor laws in the country on the planet. They take care of their worker. We seem to love this idea of being held hostage, almost.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that the business community would oppose any of this, but think about it down through history. They kind of had to be dragged into the reality of life, and I think a lot of them, especially small businesses, have realized, hey, you know, I can use that incentive to get better people, use that as a benefit that I give to my people, you know.
You know, the numbers that she came out with, and, you know, employers were happy with it, the people were happy with it, morale was good, all in the 90% range. To me, again, you look at this stuff and it works. It's, you know, if you treat people decent, you're going to be happy and they're going to be happy. And this, again, goes back to the whole labor argument that I make, which is, you know, on the job, you should have some security. You should have a voice. And that makes for a happier workplace. That makes for a more secure workplace. And a more cooperative one. And well, those employers who treat their people well, they should be rewarded.
the employers who are, for lack of a better word, Rick, are enlightened. Enlightened self-interest is maybe a good word. They understand that they can use this. And some employers will always consider this a threat, but the smart ones will understand that this is a positive long-term. It's good for morale. If you have happy people, you're going to have productive people, and that certainly affects the bottom line. So it's pretty much a case of enlightened self-interest, and I think slowly business community is starting to realize that if it's done properly and within reasonable bounds, it can be a positive.
You know, I go back to when my children were born. And again, you know, having those first weeks, and it's, you know, this is why I don't bash Clinton all that much. Well, I do kind of, but not as much as I probably would. That time that I was able to spend at home with them, you're never going to get that back. That's bonding time. That's important time to where they're just experiencing the world. And yeah, I know I sound like, you know, a big wimp, but you know, or
No. You were a good father, Rick. I mean, you did what more fathers should do.
But I wouldn't give that back, and it cost me considerably. I lost many weeks of pay over it. But it's time that you're never going to give back. It's priceless. The first this and the first that and the first time they hold their head up and the first smile and all that stuff. If we're truly, you know, and this is where I'm talking to my Republican friends who love to tout themselves as the party of family values. Isn't that something we want for everybody? The ability to be there in those moments. You know, I had a friend of mine ask the question, you know, are we a society that works to live or lives to work? And all too often, the voices keep telling that we live only to work. As where I think, you know, at the end of it, if you have a middle ground where, you know what, you got to work, but your work should benefit not only society, but your family as well. And you should be able to be there and share in that. So, again, the family thing, the Family Medical Leave Act, 100% in favor. I wish we could get some paid part of it. And I think Ruth Milkman is right. That stuff starts at the state level. I would love to see it happen here in Pennsylvania. It's probably not going to happen because the business community will lose their mind, for one, even though it is paid for out of a payroll tax, much like unemployment compensation is here in Pennsylvania, where we pay on every penny of our income. But, you know, this benefits you and me. Nobody's going to take that up. It's rare, very rare, that you find legislation that benefit us.
Well, the one hope is, as you mentioned, do it state by state. You know, right now, you probably couldn't get it passed, but there are some states where you might have a shot.
Yeah, well, you know, it's in this economic climate, I don't know.
Well, you know, you mentioned economic climate. I mean, the truth is, sadly, that there's some parents that had two jobs and couldn't take that opportunity. And once it's gone forever.
And I go back, and I was fortunate. I had a very good-paying union job. It enabled me to put some money aside and prepare for that. You look at the stagnant wages of the last 30 years, and even, you know, to be honest, my wages were stagnant. It makes it much harder. And, you know, for me, simple answer is providing these insurance
plans. Well, you were a little bit like me when the guy you don't particularly like, Bill Clinton, was president. A lot of us, you know, had some pretty good times, especially in the return we got in our 401ks. And you were prudent enough to put money aside when the going was good.
Well, my kids were born when Bush was president. That's their legacy.
Oh, well, but I got to tell you, my 401k came in an awful lot of money when while Bill was president, and there's some things he did to this day I don't like. But you know, Bob Dole, I got to tell you, would not have been a good president for working people. If you remember, he filibustered labor law reform, which was badly needed then, and it's even more so now, 20 years later.
Anyway, we're gonna take a quick break. We come back. Dan Miller, Pennsylvania. He's the founder of the GLBT Business Association here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, also an activist. We're right back after this.
listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Time for another Gooberhead Award, presented periodically to those in the news who have their tongues running 100 miles an hour but forgot to put their minds in gear. Today, I've got a mess of GOP goobers for you, three politicos who keep stumbling over things like facts. First, John Kyle, the Arizona senator who tried to kill a bill in December that will finally provide medical benefits for those firefighters, police, and other heroic 9/11 rescuers who are now horribly ill because of the toxins they absorbed at Ground Zero. Kyle wailed that Democrats had rushed the bill to the floor without a hearing. Rushed? John, 9/11 happened a decade ago, and many of the heroes have already died waiting in vain for Congress to act, including the callous inaction by you and your party during all those years that Republicans controlled Congress and the White House. No hearing? John, the Senate Committee on Health held one last June, and you could have participated had you just walked down the hall from your office. But you chose not to. Next come a couple of stumblebone governors. Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota recently blasted Obama for bloating the public payroll by 590,000 government jobs since 2008. Governor, Obama didn't take office until 2009. In fact, in Obama's two-year tenure, the number of public employees is down by 300,000. Then there's Rick Perry of Texas, who says he hates big government. Echoing the noted historian, Glenn Beck, Rick says that big bad government started when Woodrow Wilson pushed the 16th Amendment into the Constitution, creating the income tax. That's a punchy political anecdote, only it's false. The 16th Amendment was approved under a Republican president before Wilson took office. This is Jim Hightower saying, goobers never let facts get in the way of a good story.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Today in labor history, the Pennsylvania Superior Court ruled that employers can fire workers for being gay. One, I got to find out how they know. Two, what does it matter? But you think that that would be the last thing. Are you a productive employee? Yes. Do you come to work every day? Yes. Oh, you're gay? Sorry, you're fired. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Especially with Monday being MLK Day, I thought it would be important to talk about this because, you know, we seem to think we have all these rights on the job that we really don't have. And this is one that I would think kind of should be there. Anyway, I want to talk to the guy who this case is based on, Dan Miller. He is the founder of the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Business Association here in Harrisburg. He's also an activist. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hello, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, I'm reading through this article. I can't believe this is possibly true.
Well, it's true.
Explain to me how did this all transpire?
Well, I began working with a CPA firm in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, and I worked there for almost 5 years. And I am a CPA. I also have an MBA in finance. And shortly after I was hired, one of the partners left, and they offered to make me on the partner track, which I accepted. So I was going to become a partner in this CPA firm. And during that time period, I also became comfortable with myself, my sexual orientation, and in part of that progress was also becoming a sort of an activist for gay rights, because as you just mentioned, we have very few rights based on sexual orientation in Pennsylvania. And one, it's perfectly legal to fire people because they're gay in Pennsylvania back then, and still today it is. Anyway, over the course of this, what happened was after I had worked there for many years, he wasn't my partner. We were going to become partners within the next year. We were even looking at buildings to buy together to house the practice. And that summer, there happened to be quite a few gay bashings in the Harrisburg area. I was a leader of the gay community on one of the organizations. There was a meeting. The media came, and someone had to speak to the media. None of the other leaders were willing to do that because we were all afraid about our jobs, mainly.
Right.
But I was willing to do that. So I spoke out. I was on television, and subsequently I got fired from my own job at that point in time.
And you end up taking this to court? Because, I can't believe that it's even legal that that happens. I understand Pennsylvania is an at-will employment state, but to me that seems just plain wrong, dumb, a whole bunch of words that are coming to my mind right now.
Well, actually, it's one of the ironic things that's tough for gays and lesbians is that I think the majority, when you look at polls, the majority of the population thinks we already have this right and that you can't discriminate against people for being gay. And I think it's about 80% of the population would support a law saying you can't discriminate it, but yet we can't get either the Congress to act or we can't get the state legislature to act here in Pennsylvania.
So even to this day, 16 years later, it's still possible, it's still legal for an employer to fire somebody strictly simply because of what they do in the confines of their own home?
Yep, that is correct, unless it's in a municipality has enacted an ordinance. For example, the city of Harrisburg does have an ordinance within its city limits. I think Philadelphia has one, Pittsburgh. There are some other cities that have them. But other than those isolated areas, in the whole state, it's perfectly legal.
Or I would assume if you have a union contract that would preclude someone from being fired as well. Because most union contracts, I think all union contracts would protect someone in that instance.
And of course, that's a voluntary type of arrangement. It's not necessarily legal, a law. And many, I think all Fortune 500 companies, or almost all Fortune 500 companies, have a policy where gays cannot be discriminated against in their company. So business is out ahead of it. The unions are out ahead of it. But unfortunately, our legislature hasn't caught up with it yet.
Yeah, because one of the questions my producer thought of is, he was thinking about how difficult it must have been at this time, this whole coming out process, and which he was wondering which is harder. Was it harder coming out to your family or coming out to your employer? And I would go, I wouldn't even have thought of the employer in that equation.
Well, I mean, I didn't come out to the employer. It wasn't. It was forced on me.
Yeah.
It happened in that way. And it's a funny thing. I didn't think it would be an issue with my employer, actually, because of the reason you had said. I had been there for 5 years. I was a very good employee, the best employee he had had up to that point. He had told me he wanted to make me a partner. So I made him a lot of money. There's a lot of positive things going on. And I thought, well, and it's been 5 years. I figured he knows me as a person now.
Yeah. What would you say to someone who's kind of in that situation now? Where they're, because I got to imagine, given this decision, that there are a lot of gay people who are scared to death that they're going to be found out. I mean, you look at the military with the don't ask, don't tell stuff. I can't imagine. What would you say to somebody in that situation now?
Well, I think it's important to, it's difficult to live that lie, like if you're in a military or you're working in an environment where you can't truly be yourself and when everybody can talk about their families or their spouses and you can't do it. That's a difficult thing. So it's not something, so if it's not a good situation for you, I would say prepare to go, move to someplace else, or not physically move, but, go to another job where you can maybe be open. Or else, try to be open, but prepare for whatever the consequences may be.
Now, I got to tell you, as a union person, that kind of thing enrages me. what you just said. You shouldn't have to leave because of who you are. I'm a firm believer in organize and make your condition better and demand some rights by doing that organizing. And I know you guys have, in the LGBT community have done an awful lot of organizing and movement. But I think labor is a place where you guys should be looking as well.
I agree. I mean, and labor is on our side. Hopefully we can get business on our side. I was at a business event tonight, and the business leaders are already, they understand that discrimination isn't good for their business or their customer base. But we just have to get some of these legislators to agree with us so we can pass a law that covers the entire state.
See, I think things are probably, and maybe you help me if I'm wrong, because I really don't know, but I would think today if something like that were to happen, you would have a lot more people standing in front of your employer's place of business.
I think things are very different. I mean, you can, and just the fact that we had a room full of leaders, there was an event where a lot of gay people, leaders in the community came, and this is why I was on television, and there were maybe 10 or 15 of us, and that none of them were willing to speak to the media. Well, today I think you would have a whole different, different crowd. It's very different. I mean, people are a lot more visible, and especially young people. They're a lot more connected via the internet, etc., and so you don't feel as isolated as a gay person growing up as maybe you did, 20 or 30 years ago.
So, I mean, last question I guess I have for you, in looking at this, you were really the first person that this, you're almost like an iconic figure in this realm, I would think. People have got to look to you as saying, thank you, it sucked you got fired, but, it brought awareness, I think.
Well, it was.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, it was, a few years ago, but it, at the time, it, did have some national news on it, and it was a focus. And it does outrage people when they realize what the facts of the case are, because actually I didn't even sue my employer. After I was fired, didn't know what to do, so I started my own business, and approximately a third of the clients came to my business.
For them.
Yeah, and that's what my employer sued me, because those people left his business and he was trying to get, payment for that action. When in fact it was his action that caused his business to deteriorate, not my action.
I hope he's out of business now.
I don't believe he is, but I have a very successful business, and so it has all worked out very well for me.
And good for you. Last question. Advice moving forward for folks?
From employment or just gay rights? I mean,
this is part of this discussion that I'm uncomfortable, and I don't know if you can tell I'm uncomfortable. And I think the reason I wanted you to have come on is I think that it's good that we uncomfortable things get talked about. Does that make any sense?
Well, I think that for Americans in general to see that there is this huge group of people, citizens, and they're good, productive citizens who are second-class citizens. I'm a second-class citizen. I don't have any of the protections that others do. I actually am in a relationship of 20 years. We have two children, but our family doesn't have any of the benefits that other families have. Can have a heterosexual family that has the ability to get married and share benefits, etc. And taxes, there are so many areas where this entire group of citizens are second class, and it just doesn't speak to the American experience, in my opinion, or the even what we learned in grade school, where we pledge allegiance and we're all justice for all and equality for all. It's just not necessarily there.
And I agree. And that's that's a good place to start. Dan Miller, I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on and talking.
Well, thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after that.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally, so that'd be nice. You know, I got to be honest, I think I blew that interview right at the end badly, because it's another one of those issues, and it's another one of those things that I'm uncomfortable talking about. I think a lot of people are uncomfortable about it, and I'm one of those people who are too stupid to not admit when I'm uncomfortable with something. And, you know, I didn't want to put him on the spot, but I did want, I wanted to try and have, you know, some type of a connection there where you're trying to bridge the gap, if you will, or it's just a bunch of BS.
And himself well. I think he said, look, he said, I'm well qualified. I did a good job. I've done everything my employer asked. The only reason that I got the shaft, in other words, is because I was gay. And that is wrong. And we know this is a society. When are we going to put this issue behind us? Probably never, but at least we can legally put in some laws which assure a certain amount of justice. I mean, some of the things that happen to gay people just... You look at it and you just shake your head. And they're done by so-called, and maybe I'm going to get in trouble saying this, Rick, but all too often, they're done by people who profess to be Christians. And I shake my head. I just shake my head.
But again, you know, it's one of those things where it's not really my issue. But, you know, I'm on their side. I think it's an abomination that we don't have equal rights for everybody. I mean, if you want to talk about the Constitution, we all have the right to pretty much do our thing.
What does the Pledge of Allegiance say? Liberty and justice for all. I mean, you and I both know if you really want to be honest with yourself and as a nation, You got to kind of cringe at that. It's liberty and justice sometimes for those who have the political power, liberty and justice for those who have the money. All too often, this is one of these issues.
Yeah, my grandfather always said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. And I've tried to live by that. I don't worry about what other people do. As long as it's not affecting me,
but,
you do what you got to do.
But I guess you and I are stupid. We don't understand it, that, you know, this man is a gay man, and somehow it has something to do with the guy down the street getting a divorce. Or the 50%. Now it's up to 50%, the heterosexuals, when they get married.
Yeah,
they wind up in divorce.
Now, such a good
now job somehow these whack jobs have tried to say, well, it's because these gays. I mean, cut me a break.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that. The story about, you know, my one good story on that. I used to drive up into Massachusetts, and we would go to the hotel there when I was driving truck for a living. We would go stay at the hotel, and then we'd come back the next day. Well, this guy that was on the regular run up there, he was up there three nights a week. He had a wife and a couple of kids back in Pennsylvania, and he had a girlfriend and a kid in Massachusetts. And we're having lunch one day, and there was a story had come up, and this was years ago. And he said, yeah, they're ruining the sanctity of my, those gay people are ruining the sanctity of my marriage. And I'm going, oh, yeah. Yeah, they're doing it. They're the ones who knocked up the woman up in Massachusetts, and you're hiding the girlfriend and the kid up there.
Maybe he was just secretly a Mormon, Rick. You just don't understand.
Man, well, hey, you know, maybe I don't understand, but I don't see how that has anything to do with me.
I mean, the truth is, humankind can find justification for almost any evil if we really want to look hard enough. And we really hate enough, we're going to find a reason to justification to do it.
Yeah, it makes no sense to me. You know, if you're against gay marriage, say no. If someone comes up to you and asks you to marry him, you know, say no. Yeah, I actually had someone, you know, kind of, you know, hit
ask
on me,
you to
I
get
guess.
Married? Huh?
Well, not yeah, ask me to
or
get married.
Was he drunk and blind? Or what? I had to say that right.
Actually,
was he drunk and blind?
I didn't have a breathalyzer and I didn't have an eye chart, so I don't know.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But at the end of it, you know, one of those things where, you know, I've had a moment where someone comes up to me and says, hey, you know, what are you, you single? You whatever, you know. And he's, no, but thanks for asking. Unlike Tucker Carlson, who, you know, somebody, he claims someone made a pass at him, and he left, got a friend, and came back and claims he beat the guy up. I don't believe him.
He probably, you know, there was a look of terror in the guy who he beat up or had his buddy beat up, all 140 pounds with his bow tie. Boy, that's an intimidating sight, huh?
Well, I mean, that bow tie, you know, they say there's this thing called gaydar, and I think bow ties are the magnet.
You know what? He's a poster boy for being squirrely. That's all I got to say. Yeah. Although he doesn't wear it anymore. I mean, maybe he got the message.
Because somebody smacked him.
Bow ties are persona non grata.
You know, it's just amazing stuff. And what amazes me is in this day and age, we're still talking about this. It's still an issue. Man, get over it. And I guess this is where the libertarian part of me is. Where I don't care what other people are doing in the confines of their own four walls, you know, as long as they're consenting adults.
Amazes me, Rick, and here's where maybe I'm a little bit unfair to the religious community, but some in the religious community say, well, it's still a choice, and they have that choice. And
I don't care. I just don't. I don't care if it's a choice or if it isn't, or if it's, you know, I don't.
Now, let's see. It's pretty simple for me.
If you want to live that way, God bless you.
There's studies, scientific evidence, right-wing religious nut. Who am I going to believe? I think I'll go with common sense, which tells me that they were probably born that way.
Well, like my one friend said, while we were 10 years old looking at a copy of his father's Playboy magazine, he said, do you remember that time that we were looking at that? And I said, sure. He goes, you were looking at the woman in the centerfold? He said, I was looking at the Marlboro Man. And I said, really?
Did that give him a clue?
No, but, you know, I go, really? Because he's pretty ugly.
The Marlboro Man?
Yeah, he was kind of a weathered old guy. I'm going, you're 10 years old looking at, you know?
Wasn't he the cowboy?
I don't know. Yeah, something along those lines. But, you know, it's just plain, plain, just amazing stuff. Anyway, so we can move away from that now. Because, look, you know, you can... It's frustrating on so many levels that there's so many of these issues that we're still talking about that should be already done.
What aggravates me on every level, and he's a classic example on every level, these people, take away the fact that they're gay, they're doing everything that conservatives want them to be. They want them to be responsible, obey the laws, go out there and work hard, be a contributing member to society, and they do that. And yet, that's not good enough. They have to subscribe to their narrow-mindedness, bigotry, and hatred. Unbelievable.
Anyway, the U.S. Treasury Department is planning to launch a pilot program to deliver tax refunds through debit cards. How nice is that? They want to cut down on the expense of paper checks, and they want to aid lower-income taxpayers who don't have bank accounts. According to the Times, about 600,000 low- and moderate-income taxpayers nationwide, a slice of those earning $35,000 or less annually, will receive letters inviting them to activate a debit card that they can receive direct deposits. Probably not a bad idea because, you know, you get these check-cashing places who are just an absolute ripoff. But half of the 6,000 offers from the Treasury will carry a $4.95 monthly fee, while the rest will be free. Again, you know, you go to this idea, we're going to charge them. The lowest income people are the ones who always get the shaft. At least that's the way it seems to me.
Well, I mean, look what they do with these loan sharks. I mean, these companies can come in, advance your money. I mean, that's basically... What these companies are doing is legalized theft.
Now you got, Montel Williams is now hawking that stuff.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. I used to have a lot of respect for him. I mean, Montel, are you that bad off?
Montel, buddy,
I know,
come on.
Didn't he have, what did he have cancer before?
I don't know what he had.
What did he beat? He did beat something. And then for a while he wasn't in good shape.
I don't remember, but whatever it was, the drugs must have went to his head because he's now hawking bad loans on TV.
I mean, come on, you're exactly right, Montel. I mean, are you that hard up for money? I mean, you know,
amazing.
Show some integrity. I mean, really.
But you know, there's a lot of money to be made in ripping poor people off. I mean, look at those payday loans, especially the military folks. Who are the ones who are really getting screwed in all this? And you go, really? The people that we're calling heroes are the people that were allowed to get shafted? I would think that at some point you'd try and put a stop to it. At least the military would.
Well, you know, I remember when I had my training in the military. I mean, there's a lot of guys that love to play cards, right? And sometimes you don't win. What I'm saying is that kind of lifestyle tends to be, you know, up and down. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And when you lose, you still have to eat, you know, if you're going anywhere, unless you want to stay on base and eat the Army or the Navy or the Air Force food, which, I don't know, I guess you can, but most guys in the service, they want to get out, they want to go in town or whatever. They want to be regular people.
Yeah, but these are most of the stories that I'm hearing are families who are trying to get by while their spouses are being deployed.
Oh, isn't that
horrible? I don't think they're the ones who are playing cards.
I mean, there's another issue. I mean, we like to tell them, especially Bush and the Republicans, how they love the troops, but yet they're, you know, at times they're being discriminated against when it comes to taking care of these wounded veterans. We don't want to allocate the money. I mean, we like to talk, but when it comes to backing you up with money. Wow, sometimes and I got to tell you, and I mean this sincerely, sometimes when it comes to taking care of those veterans, I'm ashamed of my country. I'm absolutely ashamed, because to me, that's a sacred trust. You asked a man or a woman to die for their country. You have an obligation to take care of them when they are wounded, either you know, as far as their mental health or physically, or they lose an eye or a limb. We have a sacred responsibility to take care of them, and often we don't. Or worse yet, while a husband or a wife is off fighting for their country, their spouse can't get by and doesn't make enough money. I mean, that's just horrible. I mean, we just don't do an adequate job taking care of our troops. We just don't.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
For me and you, and I say to myself,
it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Harry Moser says the reshoring initiative he founded has the potential to bring back U.S. jobs lost to offshoring to China and other countries overseas. He says the key is for corporations to consider the true total cost of ownership of offshoring compared to domestic operations. Moser has developed a software for companies to discover all the true total costs involved, which he says many companies underestimate by 20%.
The objective of the initiative is to change the sourcing mindset, and it's a very strong mindset these days. Right now, offshore is cheaper. The logic behind this, the reason to believe that there's a chance for it to work, is a study that was done in 2009 that shows that 60% of manufacturers apply only rudimentary or simple total cost models. They ignore 20% or more of the total cost of offshore products.
UAW President Bob King told the Automotive News Global Congress in Detroit that as the union tries to organize foreign transplant auto factories in the U.S., his message to those companies is that the UAW has changed its philosophy.
We have completely discarded the outdated remnants of us versus them mentality that resulted in the past in rigid work rules and narrow job classifications.
But King also says the unfettered right to organize is a must, and he warned foreign car makers against obstructing the UAW's organizing efforts.
We will launch a global campaign to brand that company as a human rights violator.
North Dakota is attempting to make it more difficult for workers to leave a job without giving 10 days' notice. Jesse Russell reports.
Many states have laws protecting employees from being laid off without receiving a reasonable amount of notice from employers. But what about employees that don't give employers enough notice? North Dakota is considering a bill that would allow businesses to withhold accrued time off if a worker doesn't give 10 days notice before quitting. The North Dakota AFL-CIO is against the bill, with President David Chemnitz saying during a committee hearing on Wednesday that it would tie the hands of workers who may need to suddenly leave a job for a reason of harassment or for medical emergencies. The bill would specifically target employees who have been at a business for less than 2 years.
Should a governor have the right to ban state employees from calling into radio talk shows? Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee believes he does and has placed such a ban on state workers under his control. Under the ban, workers may not call into for-profit talk radio programs during state work hours. Chafee did clarify that the ban applies specifically to for-profit radio, and officials are allowed to go on public radio stations like National Public Radio. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember to check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Texas Governor Rick Perry is criticizing Illinois for raising taxes and predicts the hikes will be a recruiting boom for Texas. You know, I listen to that and I go, you know, isn't that like one of those Ten Commandment things, thou shalt not beggar thy neighbor. Because if I remember my understanding of the Ten Commandments, there was that whole covet thing. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. It's one of those things that I got to be honest, one of the sins that I commit every day. There are two of them. There's a nice looking woman in the neighborhood. I look at her and I look at the car she drives and I go, yep, a lot of coveting. So two sins right there. And I look at Rick Perry, looking at all the industry that's in Illinois, kind of sinful in my mind. Anyway, he says the governor of neighboring states like Indiana and Wisconsin will be encouraging businesses to leave Illinois to go there because why? Race to the bottom. The lower the taxes are in Wisconsin and Indiana, the more businesses may go there and take advantage of that, forcing Illinois to race to the bottom with them. And Texas will be there as well. As you know, this week, Illinois raised the taxes to fill their $15 billion deficit. Why? Because we've been giving all these tax breaks to these big corporations, to the very wealthy for so long that you have these massive holes. Now, you've got people who are saying, look, Perry in Texas has got this big deficit as well, just like they have in Illinois. He's taking a different approach. He said, like Tom Corbett here, no taxes. Not going to raise taxes. And he says, oh, but, you know, it's not going to be doom and gloom. So if it's not doom and gloom, massive cuts, what is it? He seems to have this bizarre vision that, you know, if we can just beggar thy neighbor, if we can just steal some of the work from Illinois, we'll be okay. And, you know, I take this back to our discussion with Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress and this whole states' rights thing. That whole argument is a race to the bottom. You know, you look here in Carlisle where, you know, there in Carlisle where Carlisle Tire and Wheel was for 93 years. The state of Tennessee offered them a large pot of money, and the company left. Where'd that money come from? I would argue a lot of it probably came from you and me here in Pennsylvania. But we've got to stop this whole beggar thy neighbor economic development. It's got to stop at some level. And when you look at this issue with the taxes, that's going to be the next front as well. States that are willing to cut social programs, states that are willing to lay off their public sector workers, states that are willing to break down their environmental protections. Those are the ones where the employers are going to go to. And it's going to bring us all down. Because eventually, Illinois is going to have to come down. And that's where the argument is supposed to be. That's where the people who make it want it to be. You and I always lose. The games, it's a rigged game. It's like going to a mafia card game. You pay you pay the vig every hand, and you end up losing.
I believe Governor Walker is beaten, quite frankly. I heard it, believe earlier in the week, possibly last week. Governor Walker, Wisconsin, we talked about. The Republicans are, you know, seriously going after some businesses. And in Illinois, of course, this is the same governor.
Well, on Thursday, they were saying, escape to Wisconsin.
This is the same governor that said, well, we don't need high-speed rail. And he canceled a project that would have created tens of thousands of jobs. And now he's going after tort reform. I mean, he's really pushing the right-wing Republican mantra.
You don't think we're going to be going after tort reform here at Pennsylvania?
I'm sure sometime in the next 4 years there will be.
Going to steal your right away to
there's damages? I'm sure the powers that be, the powers behind the powers, sitting behind God knows what desk, have already their Christmas list drawn up, and the governor probably has it on his desk.
I mean, stop and think about that for a second. The people who want government out of your lives, they're the very people who want the government right in your life telling you cannot sue for damages. It's like the whole workman's comp thing, which is another one of those things that it's always amazed me, that we've given up our constitutional right to seek damages for things that have happened to us as workers in exchange for saying, okay, well, we'll be taken care of in the hour that happens. That sacred bond has been broken.
You can take that to health care. I mean, I just love this right-wing mantra that, well, you know, one way that we can control costs is to limit your right to sue. Well, there's only one problem. The same people that want to limit your right to sue are not willing to go to the doctors' organizations and say, you people got to do something about the small minority of doctors who are incompetent in creating most of the situations that lead to lead to cases which you say shouldn't exist. notoriously doctors' organizations, and this goes back probably into the late 70s. I can remember Public Citizen coming out and railing against doctors' organizations. And quite honestly, ironically, Pennsylvania was one of the worst. They would hide doctors. They would protect doctors. They don't police their own ranks. If these doctors' organizations are really serious about doing something for the public and health and limiting their lawsuits, well, then you've got to do something about the people who are creating that on your side, and they're not willing to do that. They circle the wagons. And that's one of the big problems.
Well, yeah. Well. Last night you talked about Evergreen Solar, one of the companies up in Massachusetts that's going out of business. And there's a movement right now to force the company to pay back the economic development money that was given them back in 2007. Some $58 million in state subsidies was given to this company when it opened its solar panel plant in 2008. The package included $21 million in grants, almost $23 million in tax incentives, and a $1 per year lease for 23 acres of land and $13 million for infrastructures to infrastructural improvements to their facility. And I got to be honest, you know, you look at this, at some point we've got to hold these people accountable for the money that we're giving out. But the bigger picture here for me is a solar panel plant in the U.S. is going out of business. Why? Because we're not investing in it. You know, this sounded like a great idea when they did it back in 2007. I mean, but
what does that tell you about us, Rick? I mean, hello, the sun's been here for thousands of years. It's not like all of a sudden we discovered solar power.
Well, what it tells me is that our bizarre trade policies are allowing cheaper Chinese-made solar panels into the country, and companies like this can't compete. And again, it's, you know, like we were talking about with Ruth Milkman about the playing field. You know, you make rules, make sure they're consistent, make sure they're across the board, and everybody plays by them, and business will figure out how to adapt. But you look at our trade policies at every turn when you start a company like this, and, you know, I don't know all the financial particulars with Evergreen, but this is a growing industry.
Well, think of how different this country would be on several important levels, Rick, if we would have listened to Jimmy Carter and gone his route and invested smartly in solar power. I mean, he was what, 35 years ago? I mean, not only would we have created jobs, but we would have lessened our dependence on oil. And maybe, just maybe, and I don't care what George Bush says, one of the reasons we went into Iraq, because we had our eye on their oil. Well, you know, maybe if we weren't dependent on foreign oil, maybe just maybe, we wouldn't have been over there and lost all the men that we lost. And invested what? Between, they say the total cost could be as high as between $3 and $4 trillion. Maybe, just maybe, the entire history of our country would be completely different if we would have done what's best for this country. We would have followed Jimmy Carter.
And here's what Jimmy Carter said.
Crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Well, you know, we all know what happened. You know, Ronald Reagan came into office, tore the solar panels out, and said, oil, you're secure. You go back and you look at that, man, and you go, the lost opportunity. And when he started talking about solar banks, he started talking about, you know, the solar industry.
Well, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Now, had we gotten that 20%, and this has been extensively written about, had we hit that 20% mark, we wouldn't need Iran. We wouldn't need Afghanistan. We wouldn't need to be in Iraq. We wouldn't need the Middle East oil, because that's about what we were getting. Why do you think he said 20%? That was a very strategic goal, to get us out of the Middle East, to get us away from dependence on those folks. And again, you know, you go back to the Reagan years, man. It was all about appeasing big oil.
You were probably too young, but I wasn't. I remember.
I said, watch the speech.
No. I mean, 78 when the Arabs turned off the speech, or was it 79?
73.
There were twice they did it. The second time they did it, when Jimmy Carter was president, I remember those long lines. And the economy went in the tank, but yet they blamed him for the incompetence. Here's the irony. His policies would have precluded those kinds of situations if we would have followed him. But he was the victim of previous presidents who didn't do a lot about our dependence on oil. That's the irony. And that's why he lost. I mean, he was considered this. I remember the Republicans mocking him. And remember, it's dawn in America and Ronald Reagan and America's the greatest and blah, 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 blah. Jimmy Carter was right. If we would have followed what Jimmy Carter said, we'd be a different nation today.
Now you got to understand, he's the guy who started the Department of Energy. Why? Because we needed to have an overall energy plan. And you know, I love hearing the Bushes of the world. Well, we need an energy plan. And their energy plan is just to consume more energy because it's good for business. That's the plan. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're back after this.
Together. The Rick Smith Show.
Time for another Gooberhead Award. Presented periodically to those in the news who have their tongues running 100 miles an hour but forgot to put their minds in gear. Today, I've got a mess of GOP goobers for you. Three politicos who keep stumbling over things like facts. First, John Kyle, the Arizona senator who tried to kill a bill in December that will finally provide medical benefits for those firefighters, police, and other heroic 9/11 rescuers who are now horribly ill because of the toxins they absorbed at Ground Zero. Kyle wailed that Democrats had rushed the bill to the floor without a hearing. Rushed? John, 9/11 happened a decade ago, and many of the heroes have already died waiting in vain for Congress to act, including the callous inaction by you and your party during all those years that Republicans controlled Congress and the White House. No hearing? John, the Senate Committee on Health held one last June, and you could have participated had you just walked down the hall from your office. But you chose not to. Next come a couple of stumblebum governors. Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota recently blasted Obama for bloating the public payroll by 590,000 government jobs since 2008. Governor, Obama didn't take office until 2009. In fact, in Obama's two-year tenure, the number of public employees is down by 300,000. Then there's Rick Perry of Texas, who says he hates big government. Echoing the noted historian, Glenn Beck, Rick says that big bad government started when Woodrow Wilson pushed the 16th Amendment into the Constitution, creating the income tax. That's a punchy political anecdote, only it's false. The 16th Amendment was approved under a Republican president before Wilson took office. This is Jim Hightower saying, goobers never let facts get in the way of a good story.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.com.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You know, earlier in the program, we were talking about Republican Senator Mike Lee for his really... And I'm not going to call it crazy. I'm going to call it evil. Yeah. his evil position on child labor and, you know, this bizarre constitutional theory that he has. He's back again. You know, if you remember during the campaign, he had called for a 40% cut in federal spending, 40% cut in all spending, except military, of course, to balance the budget. When reality set in during the campaign, and his opponent pointed out the fact that it was ridiculous and irresponsible, he kind of backed away. Then last week, my girlfriend, Michelle Bachmann, she proposed some really outlandish budget cuts, claiming that her staff, that she and her staff had sat down and, you know, they looked over the federal budget. You know, they went through with the comb and they went through the federal budget and just their first swipe across the budget, so to speak, she said, we've come up with about $450 billion worth of cuts. Now, understand, their first swipe produced nothing. Nothing actually that we could look at. No specifics, just rhetoric. Just the good things that they're good at. And Senator Rand Paul, he said that this month he'll introduce a bill that in the next year they will slash $500 billion. And again, like the others, no details, just rhetoric. Now, not to be outdone, this week at a town hall meeting in Alabama, Richard Shelby, Republican from Alabama, saw Bachmann's $450 billion first swipe and Rand Paul's $500 billion hallucination, and he raised it to $1 trillion. That's right. He's going to cut $1 trillion from our budget. Now, understand, our budget is about $3.8 trillion. So in order for him to cut $1 trillion, that's 30% right across the board. Understand that. Now, he said in 1980, the U.S. owed about $900 billion, which is true. Now, in 2010, he says the debt is $13.5 trillion, and that estimate is expected to hit $23 trillion by 2020, unless there's change. He said, quote, this is a road to financial destruction. No family could operate like that. We continue to borrow instead of cutting spending. The day of reckoning is coming. Again, you know, families, you know, they love to use that kitchen table rhetoric. If your bills are such that you need more money, you raise revenue too, along with cutting costs. But there's a point at which you can't cut any more costs. You are going to have to raise revenue. And I'm arguing we're somewhere at that point where we need to start talking about raising revenue. Shelby has said there are tough choices to be made, and government should be streamlined. He said, I honestly believe we could cut 30% across the board. Now understand, on $3.8 trillion for the fiscal year 2011, that would equal about $1.14 trillion in slashing and burning. And here's the simplistic reasoning we get from them. And I'm not saying they're simplistic. Their message, very much simplistic. The stuff they want us to know. It's like sitcoms. They've dumbed it down. Way down. But according to Shelby, all Congress is, all they have to do, walk down the hall to the Department of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse, and close the door. It's that simple. Or get a truck to backfill in that giant hole that we throw our tax dollars in, and then we burn them. And fill it with dirt. This way well, wait a second. If we're talking about Republicans, fill it with Muslims. Better yet. He says to review and analyze every program that we've started in the last 30 years. So anything from 1980 till today, we need to reexamine and see if it's still working. And my question is how do you mean by working? Do you mean like feeding people, or do you mean making profit for corporations? There's a whole different way of looking at things. Now, he's talking about $1 trillion in cuts. Remember the grand pledge? Remember the GOP pledge that we pledge? Remember that, the great pledge? Their lofty goal was to cut $100 billion in spending. And now since November, they've actually revised that lofty goal by half downward. I mean, you have to give them credit there. You know, they found half of that because what they found out is there wasn't an office of waste, fraud, and abuse. There's not a giant pit where our tax dollars are burnt. So I guess if we take Shelby at his word, Granny, you better listen up, because the Republicans you voted for, they've got a guy who wants to cut your Social Security by 30%. He wants to cut your Medicare by 30%. Sorry, it's the only way. Times are tough, Granny. Buck up. Or as Sarah Palin would say, man up. But 30%, that's pretty impressive, I think. That's a pretty impressive goal. Never going to happen. But, you know, it's nice rhetoric. And that's what they're good at. They're good at rhetoric. So what should we do? What cuts are we talking about? You look at the compassionate conservative in Kansas, who's the governor there, Senator Brownback. He was former senator from Kansas there. He wants to cut funding for state mental hospitals. Cut it all. I mean, it's pretty good timing, don't you think, when everybody's saying that the guy in Arizona was crazy and needed mental health treatment. I think it's great timing. He says, you know what? We're going to eliminate all of our mental health services. We're going to cut state education to the lowest level since 2000. They're going to eliminate all of the Arts Commission in Kansas. All of that stuff. Gut, slash and burn. Interesting.
But I'm sure he'll artfully and tactfully tell you that, and with a straight face, well, none of these mentally ill are going to, they'll be taken care of. Don't worry. We'll take care of them. We'll find a way. No, the truth is, as it happened in the rest of the country when things like this happen, a lot of them wind up in jail or they'll wind up homeless.
Or dead.
Or they'll find them froze one morning. Someone will come across their frozen body, and that's the truth. That sounds brutal, but it's the truth.
You know, at the end of all of this, the pragmatic part of me says, you know, how much is this going to cost us in the long run? I was talking to somebody who works for a state representative here in Pennsylvania, and the representative gave back the state leased car. And this is kind of hysterical. And it's what I said right from the beginning, and you'll remember me saying it. He turned back in the lease, and they were getting, I think, somewhere around $600 a month for the lease of the vehicle and some upkeep, I guess. So they were getting this $600 a month lease. They gave that back. They went and they bought their own car. Now they get like $1,500 a month because they're paying for mileage. And this is exactly what I said. We'll step over a dollar to pick up a dime just so it looks like we're denying someone of something. And you look at some point, don't you think someone did a study that sat down and said, you know, it's cost effective for us to own these vehicles and lease them out or whatever? Don't you think at some point we thought that through? And the answer is most people don't think that way. They think, oh, well, you know, this is just, you know, it's ridiculous that they get this, you know, these crummy state cars. And they're by no means your luxury sedans. They're the little compacts. Have you seen a lot of the state vehicles?
I've seen some of them.
They're tiny little pieces of... But they do their job. They get where they're supposed to go. They do what they're supposed to do. But now what we've done, we're going to continue so we can... You know, we can say we honored a campaign.
Well, you know the next step. You're going to see state reps and state senators pledging to ride my bike to work.
No, you're not going to see that.
If it was someone local,
you might.
As a PR, I mean,
that sounds like
let me
Gene
ask
Stilt,
you something.
That sounds like something with Gene Stilt would do.
Would that be a good
and
PR?
And I agree with him. And would it be a good PR?
Oh, you bet.
You're not going to get
the
any.
The voters would love you. Oh, look at my representative. Don't you love him?
Are you kidding me? What you would get is you'd probably get people on the highway aiming for him while he's riding his bike. Because of how crazy our environment's become. But, you know, again, you look at this, and this is where you got to have smart people doing these things. It was a nice political soundbite. There are 16,000 cars that we're paying for. We never discussed what those cars were used for. There was none of that because that doesn't fit into a soundbite. All that says is, oh, we got all these cars. The state's paying off for all these cars. So we're going to get rid of them. And we're going to make people drive their own cars. And we're going to pay them. Last time I checked, I think it's like 52 cents a mile or 55 cents a mile that they pay.
I've talked to some conservatives, and there's one guy that you don't particularly like from my hometown who claims, and correct me if I'm wrong, constitutionally guarantees them a salary and mileage. That's it. That's it. No retirement, no medical benefits, according to his strict interpretation of the Pennsylvania Constitution.
Again, going back to this, we can't pass any laws. We can't do anything other than what's in the. It's already done. Sorry, the cat's out of the bag on that.
I mean, he's obviously another one who wants the Constitutional Convention to open all that. Open all that to informed discussion.
Nice. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Come back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it rain.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well?
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Now, as we start talking next week about repealing the health care bill, with the repeal of the job-killing bill that the Republicans are throwing at us, the state of Connecticut is claiming that a public option could save the state up to $355 million in 2014. Now, our friends over at Think Progress write, the Affordable Care Act does not establish a public option like many progressives would have hoped, me included. But it does allow states to form their own public plans. He writes today's Political Post, Pulse reports that Connecticut is aiming to do just that, and a new report from the state board in the General Assembly argues that such a plan could save upwards of $355 million in the state of Connecticut. The option called SUSNET follows a 2009 state law which sought to use a publicly administered health plan to implement health care delivery changes designed to slow the growth of costs. To me, that's That's part of what that's what has to happen. Costs have to come down first. That's why I didn't think this health care law, when they went after it, was a good idea, because I didn't think costs had gone out of control as much as needed. Now, listen to me when I say this. You know, I'm in favor of moving forward on health care reform. I'm in favor of a Medicare for All plan that we all buy into, we all pay into. But it's there for everybody from cradle to grave, because I do believe there are a lot of incentives in that to make sure that you get preventative treatments, to make sure that you have yearly doctor's appointments, yearly blood tests. Oh, I don't know, to try and prevent some things. To me, that's the way to go. But you know, if we've got to do everything else first, the public option, in my mind, would have been a better result. But here's the thing. And I said this right at the beginning of the discussion about health care. Things aren't bad enough yet. Rates had to go through the roof where the majority of people could no longer afford them. And we're heading down that path. This whole repeal thing, it's not going to happen. The real test is what the Republicans do in the House when it comes to funding it. That's where the real battles are, funding this health care bill. Because right now the Republicans could just say no, and no money goes, because they can just close the purse. So if there's no money, there's no health care reform, and they know that. But they need this very grand, this very open, this very big debate, this big fight. They need this because it's part of their political campaigning for 2 years down the road. So what I'm saying is what has to happen is insurance rates have to just keep going up and up and up and up and up to the point where folks no longer can afford it. And they no longer have health care at all. And we're heading in that direction. The more I'm looking at rates, the more I'm going, wow, this is outrageous.
Well, if you remember, it was like they reacted to health care. Right after it was passed, they reacted like spoiled children and started, you know, shooting their rates up. It was like, well, we're going to get our rate increases up before you guys do something permanently.
And this whole discussion, to me, was centered and it was really put in the wrong place. And again, I blame the Democrats for that, because they did have the power of the bully pulpit, if you will, that one of Jake's favorite sayings. But they had the floor, and they screwed it up. Why? Because a lot of money was spent convincing us that we didn't want a public option, that we didn't want a single payer. In fact, the single payer was completely off the table from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I go back to this, and I think I talked about this earlier in the week. I go back to one of my friends who remembers the Medicare, when Medicare was being implemented. And he said, you know, the insurance companies, especially the Blues, were adamantly opposed. But once it became law, they found their place. And it worked out very well for them. And that's why you haven't heard much from outwardly from some of the insurance industry. Now, they've been funneling money around the back door to let other people do their hatchet jobs. But you haven't heard much from them, because I think they know. They know they're going to find their way.
They're going to be a major player. And something that's kind of correlating what you're saying, I just read earlier in the week where there's, you know, some business groups who are finally recognizing, hey, look, you know, we got some pretty nice tax breaks here. And to repeal that is not only going to cost us money, it's going to make the whole healthcare thing uncertain again. We're better off not repealing it and learning how to handle the change in the law.
Tweaking some of the things that we're not happy with. I mean, there are some things in there that we could tweak. I mean, it's not enough for me yet. And I think eventually down the road, things are going to get worse before they get better. And maybe as we move down, because I don't think this is the answer. I think it's a step, but it's not the answer.
Well, I mean, you and I both know we met a small businessman locally in our community who said, hey, I don't know why they're demonizing. He said, I cut my, because of health care reform, I cut my cost in half. And I think this repeal, I mean, this reform will help the small businesses. And they don't have maybe the organization and the money to get their story out. But the truth is it's helped many, many thousands of small businesses to better be able to afford health care.
But again, you know, as you talk about this, as, you know, as small businesses look at their payroll and look at the what they can do. To take this off of their back would be massive, just massive. And by just having this argument over repealing it, I think is doing damage. I think it's keeping us in that, you know, if anything that you learned from the Tucson thing, from the shooting, maybe it's that kind of divisive legislation even. Because you know you're not going to win it. They're putting forth what they're calling job killer. It's in the bill. It is in the name of the bill. Repeal the job-killing health law.
Think about it. The object, especially, let's take small businesses, Rick. What's the object? Obviously, the object is to make money, to run your business. And what are we doing? We're wasting huge amounts of time and money worrying about the health care issue. And I think some in the business community are finally coming around to saying, look, enough is enough. Let's accept what was passed and deal with it, because this can be a positive. And that's what worries, I think, the Republican Party, quite frankly.
Yeah, I understand that. But, you know, you look at this piece of legislation that they're putting forth. And, I mean, right in the name of the legislation is divisiveness. There's anger. The Job-Killing Health Care Act law. You know, wait a second. You know you don't have a snowball's chance. The only reason you're proposing it, the only reason you're putting it out there is to cause division, is to cause a fight. And I got to be honest, I would respect the Republicans if they stepped forward and said, you know what, we know this isn't going to pass. We're just going to put it aside.
Well, I mean,
and they're going to vote on it on Tuesday.
Let's look at that small businessman. Now, what do you think his reaction to the Republican Party is going to be from now on? He might take a step back and say, do I really want to trust them after what they did on the health care and demagogued it? I think the Republican Party long term, and I know sometimes we don't look long term or even medium term. I think medium and long term, the Republicans, that could be a major mistake if they really are successful.
No, and we've gone over this. The reality is they know they can't win. This is about the politics. This is about showing the base that, you know, we're doing what we said we're going to do, but it's those Democrats who stopped us. And you know it's not going to pass. You know, the president has the power of the veto. It's never going to pass.
But the funding is where they could cause havoc.
And that's where they're going to. And silently they're going to be doing that. So you've given them the opportunity to outwardly say we're against it while quietly working to destroy it through funding cuts. And at the end of it, we still lose. We at the bottom. You know, I love that saying that people, I want our politicians to do the work of the people. And I always ask, well, which people? Because I would say they're pretty much doing the work of their people, the millionaire class. They're doing just well. Happy days are here again on Wall Street. Business profits through the roof. You and I, we're the ones saddled with all the risk. We're the ones saddled with all the... AIG is about ready to get out from under the federal government's control. Why? Happy times again. Because we covered their risks. Communities. I was just reading the Wall Street Journal. States and communities across this country are having an impossible time selling their bonds. The prices of anything has just gone through the roof. And the banks are holding these credit letters. And they're wanting to cash it in. So again, we're the ones who are stuck. The communities are stuck having to pay again. The banks made bad decisions. They made up these bizarre financial instruments, which are really just Ponzi schemes that you and I are now stuck with. And again, at the end of every party, who cleans up? The working people. And they have had a party. They have had a massive party on your dime. And look, when the Tea Party first popped up, I was right there. Yes, there's finally people going to take to the street, finally people who are angry. Somebody gets it. And then they were walking down the street one day, and somebody got out in front and led them right down down the wrong path. We need somebody to turn them around.
That's been reading my mind. That's exactly what we need. We need these tea parties. And you know, you're right. I congratulate them, too, for finally getting out there and being active. But we need an informed, intelligent, electorate.
But here's my problem.
For democracy to really work.
You look at these Tea Party people who got elected. They're already in the Washington culture. What did they do? Most of them hired Washington lobbyists to run their offices. I look at the guy down in Florida, that West, who wanted to hire some crazy talk show host. He's hired a lobbyist. And he's unapologetic. He wanted that woman. So at the end of this, you know, and I said this on election night, it's going to be fun for me from a jaded point of view to watch them become corrupted. Because realistically, I want career politicians. I want people who are looking out for their radical self-interest and wanting to get reelected. You know, we talked last night about term limits. And I went home last night and I'm thinking about term limits and I'm going, you know, there are people out there who think that, well, you know, if they had term limits, they could be free to do the work of the people. And I go, you know, that's really a very narrow-minded, simplistic way of looking at it, because there's the other side of that coin. They could, by not having to answer to me, they could do everything in their power to enrich themselves and not be accountable to anybody. And that's the thing about term limits that drives me nuts. There's no accountability when you're at the end of the road. You look at Rendell. Man, he's out there just flapping at the jaws. He doesn't have anybody to answer to.
But the other side, Rick, we have to eliminate certain situations in politics right now, basically the money. We got to tweak the political system so that people don't have to reach out to them. Maybe it is a stretch. Maybe that's a bridge too far to say term limits. But they do that because they're so frustrated with the system. That's the only answer that they can see. But in the end, something has to be done.
Because they don't understand the
Something
system.
Has to be done about the money.
Look, you know, we don't want ideologues. We want people who are going to do the will of the... That's how it was set up. You're going to do the will of the majority of your constituents, which again comes back down to making districts that are more representative of the people in the state, which means having compact districts, either round, square, maybe even triangles. I'm not against that. But when you start seeing these Rorschach tests where there's a string over here and a string over there, and they're, let's not forget that, there's a real problem there. And for me, I say take the money out of the equation. Make them come to us for money, the taxpayers, not the big corporations. You know, I had someone tell me that they spend the majority of their time begging for money year-round, not just in the run-up to the election, but year-round, day after day after day, begging for money.
What you're saying is, in a perfect system, if you had your choice, you'd want a political system where money isn't even a factor. Now, how do you do that?
Well, what I would do, again, you know, it comes down to matching funds. I would say that no corporations could give money. I would do away with PACs. I would do away with all of these big donors. Money would come from individuals in no more than $25 a piece, and then they would be matched by federal funds.
And you would limit the total amount?
Nope. I would say that in $25 donations, individuals, the idea is you want more individuals getting involved in the process. So if you could have Jake Long gets 10,000 people in his district to give him $25,000, the federal government would match that. Up to a certain amount in federal matching funds. But at the end of it, it comes down to small donors, more people involved, because I do think over the years we have seen the participation of voters in this country go down. We are, I think, at less than 50% of the people participating in presidential elections.
And I've been one person who has really criticized people who don't work, but in those who don't work, those who don't vote, but I got to tell you, I think you've just said encapsulated the whole problem. A lot of people feel that their vote doesn't make a difference and their wishes aren't being heard, their needs aren't being addressed.
Now, is that ever going to happen? Next week is the first anniversary of Citizens United. Corporations have their hands on the wheel. They're not giving.
And we haven't heard near enough that we should. That should be a subject that these talk show hosts would be talking about almost daily.
And we will next week. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back to wrap this up. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of healthcare and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. It seems we have a new Republican National Committee chairman. Looks like I'm not good with names, but it looks like Reince Priebus. Sound right to you? R-E-I-N-C-E. Reince. Reince.
Reince. Reince.
Priebus. P-R-I-E-B-U-S. Priebus.
Okay.
Reince Priebus. He is the
good.
Former chairman of the Wisconsin Republican Party. He, on the seventh ballot, was named as the chairman. Our bling master, he dropped out after the fourth ballot.
Bling, bling.
So, Priebus came out and said after the thing, he said, now it's time to unite the party. He thanks Steele for his service, but pledged that under his leadership, the RNC will begin to restore faith, the faith of our donors, and work hard to develop a new line of communication with state parties. So basically, Whitey's back in town is the message, because Richard Steele just wasn't able to get those donors to open their wallets.
Well, they did ask him, was it harder because you were black, being a Republican?
He better have said no.
No, he didn't. He said yes. Now, wait a minute. Let's be fair.
That's the end of
him. I mean, the truth is, what was he, $20-some million in debt? That's not, you're supposed to be in the plus. He was in the red. That doesn't look good.
Well, what's that got to do with the price of tea?
Well,
they weren't giving him money, they were expecting him to...
He's the RNC chairman. He's supposed to raise it. I mean, that's his... I don't know what to tell you. I mean, the truth is, they were pretty dismal. Of course, I'm sure that Supreme Court's ruling had something to do with it.
It had everything to do with it, because the money no longer had to be filtered through the RNC. They could take their money right to their own euphemistically named think tank or their attack group and have their message spewed right away, which, again, you know, I go back to this group that we went to see their press release, their website opening, the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, and you know, they're nothing but a front group, and what you've got are these corporations, these well-funded, these big money people throwing them money. They raised over $500,000 in a very short period of time. Why? To go after you, to go after labor unions, to go after state workers. There's a lot of money behind this. And why do they want to destroy the state workers? Because they want those contracts privatized. Why? Because there's big money. Privatization is huge money. Huge money. And it fills the coffers of the very wealthy. At the expense of who? Oh, yeah, you.
But
the people who do the work.
But, of course, they'll tell you, you know, by privatizing, we're saving you, the taxpayer.
Oh, yeah, that happens. Show me where. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. Where's this? Where are all these studies? Where's the proof? There's no proof. It's blind faith belief.
Have you heard anybody? I haven't, and I'm a little bit different than you. I like to listen to what my enemy has to say. On these conservative local talk show hosts, I haven't heard one person call in and attack Corbett for being a phony on this tax issue. I mean, this is not rocket science. If he's not asking the Marcellus Shale corporations to pay their fair share, where is he going to get the money? How is he not going to raise taxes? Waste, fraud, and abuse is, for the most part, not going to be all that much. He's going to have to find some real sources for, income to the state treasury, or pass a lot of that cost on to who? Pass them all cost on to local school districts, municipalities, and cities. And you're going to wind up paying the difference.
And that's the plan. I think that's the plan.
Why aren't they calling him on it? I don't hear anybody calling him on it. It's amazing. It's as if they're all tone deaf. I mean, I think they're in for a rude, rude awakening.
Well, we'll see. But, you know, at the end of it, how many people are going to be affected by it? You know, when you cut those social programs, initially, who gets hurt by it? The least among us, the people who are already at the margin. And those are the people that could care less to begin with in the first place. So, you know, it's going to be interesting as we move forward. And you know, I got to be honest, I'm hopeful and we had talked about this week, and I didn't get into it today, but I am told by somebody who knows that Corbett's statement on the right to work, him signing it, that never happened. And I'm going to work on trying to get someone from the right to work people over there to come on to the program and defend that. Because I think it's important. I want to hear them tell me that Corbett looked him in the eye and said he would sign it. Because from what I'm hearing, Corbett's people are saying, never happened. But, you know, again, these people lie? Tell me. Oh, please tell it to them.
No, the proof is in the pudding. We shall see in the next couple
of months. And I got to tell you, I don't think Corbett said it. I'm going to take Corbett's side on this. I don't think he said it. I think the lie is on the right to work for less people side. It's my point. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. I want to thank Brett, our chief engineer, and Knob Turner over there. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Well, they're stealing down on Wall
Washington too. No, it makes me wonder, what's a guy on Main Street to do? Always tried to be an honest, upstanding kind of guy.